Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Lusa.
This is podcast number 8, an interview conducted with Time Control scientist Dr. David Anderson on June 13th, 2015. Note that there is a prerequisite to this podcast, which is podcast number 7. It will help you understand this one. Here's Dr. David Anderson.
Well, Peter, thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be speaking with you, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. It's been quite a while since we spoke in public over a public venue, and it's good to have my feet back in the ground, and especially with you on the other side of the microphone.
Yes, and first off, I want to thank you so much for what you've contributed to my life, particularly with the adventures I've had in Romania. You're inviting me there in 2008, because as I look back to when I first met you in 1999, and I look at all the people that are in my life, most or many of those people are no longer in my life back in 1999. And although you have had an ephemeral, mysterious in and out existence in my life, you've created some of the most profound and long-lasting experiences that I've had. So I wanted to start off by acknowledging your contribution to my life and my writing and my adventures. So I wanted to thank you very much for that.
Those are very kind words, Peter. And I do appreciate them. To turn it about, I think my heart's been deeply touched, not necessarily by a lot of the great academic work that has attracted the attention of different fields of experts in Eastern Europe, but also for the work you've been doing while you're there with the United Nations Youth Projects. You've had a ripple effect that has not just touched many lives, probably shaped their course. So it seems our paths are somehow always intertwined, and there seem to be good things that come out of it for many people around us. So I also feel blessed that our paths do cross.
Great, and I hope they will cross in the future soon in the live present. Now I want to start off by just I guess I've built up some intrigue in the earlier podcast by discussing this postcard that you sent to me from Israel, and I misidentified it in the podcast. I said it was from Bethlehem, although the postcard was from Bethlehem, or was a picture of Bethlehem. The postmark I actually saw was Tel Aviv. And you had mentioned, I think, sending it from the Tel Aviv airport. But there was all this intrigue that, you know, there was a coded message in this world and time. Nothing happens by accident. If it happens, you can bet it was planned that way. That was the encrypted message you sent me. And as you told me, there was a code. That was the false code. There was a code within that. But I want to.
Yes.
Yes. Do you have anything else to say about that?
Well, yeah, it was an interesting period of time. If you remember, as you know, I've been very active in space-time research and working with different agencies and governments and institutions all around the world. And that time was quite interesting. And what I was providing you with there was a link to some very, very interesting information that at the time was present on the internet regarding China's activity. If you remember about that time, a little bit before then, I believe I was on the Art Bell show, and I talked about the China's Ministry of Defense being so wanting to get into space-time research. And what they had done was they had started a plan. If you look at the investment in space-time research being funded by governments around the world, you got small countries like Japan and South Korea. You have the United States. You have a little bit in Russia. India is probably five times more than all those others combined. And China was making a play at the time to try to recruit people through their the National People's Congress for Educational Science and Culture, as well as their Ministry of Science and Technology. And at that time, they had the second largest R&D budget in the world, which they were ratcheting up to be 10 times larger than all the space-time research institution funding around the world. And what was really interesting at that time, and I thought this was going to be happening, they started trying to recruit and steal talent from different countries. And then shortly after that, they banned any discussion in public, punishable by government prosecution, for anybody discussing time control or time travel on any level. And what I was sending you there was a link to information about the world records that China was sending on, let's call it quantum tunneling. Back in that time, if your listeners were to check the news, they would see that China was setting new world records after new world records for superluminal propagation of information, sending information faster than the speed of light. And they had just come through a major breakthrough. They still had that public. And then the Ministry of Science and Technology pulled everything, and then the National People's Congress put a ban on it. You can't even, if you're a writer in China, you can't even discuss time control or time travel. But that's the subject matter of the link, and it was more information about some of the new activities and results that they were seeing in that field.
Well, I have something to say about that. And, but the first thing is, I remember having this discussion with you, I think, when we were in Romania, and you had alluded to it pointing to the patent that is now the patent for the time reactor. So I have a contradiction in what you're saying. In other words, you're telling me China now, but I recall it being the patent on the time reactor. Do you have anything to say about that?
Well, they overlap to some degrees. Superluminal, or basically, they are two different technologies to the same end. If you want to pass information faster than the speed of light, remember, to the listeners, are going to say, hey, you can't go faster than light. You cannot move mass faster than the speed of light, but information can travel faster than the speed of light. And in a time reactor, using space-time motive force, you can actually send information faster than the speed of light. But another vehicle, totally separate, is the ability to use quantum tunneling, which actually lets you cause a reaction in, say, at a distant point in a faster time period than would be allowed, that could be traveled by the speed of light. So you're sending information faster than the speed of light back in time. There were two different means to an end. And what was very interesting at the time was, this was the first time that quantum tunneling for sending superluminal propagation of information was achieved at the same level or near the same level as a time reactor.
Okay. Thank you for answering that. The only thing I have to say about China is that they, after that ban on time control, they did, I won't say the government did, a publishing house did publish the Montauk Project and the first four books of the Montauk series in Chinese. Although earlier they had banned one of my other books, Ong's Hat, work by Joseph Matheny, they banned that work or any mention of it on the internet. So their behavior is, of course, of keen interest into the way they act in world politics. And there are some very deep threads with China that it's just not prudent to go into at this point that are fascinating, that relate to some of my adventures, including my adventures into Chinatown last October, Chinatown in San Francisco. But that's if we end up in Oakland, maybe we can even visit that place or talk about it. It's certainly an interesting connection with the Chinese secret societies that rule. Churchill referred to them as the High Cabal. But anyway, that's an interesting thing on China. What I'd like to ask now is if you could just tell us what you would like to share with listeners who are interested in your work. Of course, in the previous podcast, I explained the concept of light cones, closed time light curves, and I've also advised them to look at your website and the other podcasts or YouTubes that you've done that are online. So I'm trusting that anybody who's listening to this is up to speed with the general idea of who you are and what you're doing. So if you could give us an update right now. It's June. Today is June 13th, 2015. What could you give us an update on the Anderson Institute and what you're up to?
Well, for your listeners, again, AndersonInstitute.com is the source for a lot of information, not all, but a lot. And I've been active in the space-time research area after I left the research and development world in the U.S. military back in the 1980s. And there's just so much going on right now. For the listeners, the first thing I would say is, please understand, is that the governments around the world have been and have been greatly accelerating their investment in a word I like to call time control research. A lot of people like to talk about time travel, and yes, there's a lot of implications there. But when we talk about time control technology, there's a lot of good that comes out of the research that's being done in the world of space-time physics. And some of the first applications everybody would see and are already being demonstrated are time control applications, not necessarily moving people through time, forward and backwards, through a place in time, but actually products that would allow the acceleration and deceleration of time for all the benefits, whether it be medical, health and welfare, research, etc. The other thing I'd tell your listeners, there's a lot going on, more than we can cover in a two-hour podcast, but the breakthroughs that are happening are phenomenal, and they are accelerating. And with this, a much more serious tone than in my previous public interviews, these breakthroughs have become so powerful and offering, I don't know how to say it, the scientific knowledge and the range of technical logical possibilities that are coming out now are so enormous that the only limitations on what people will do with those and what governments will do with them will be the results of their insufficient imagination. And these governments and agencies are going through a rapid pace of the unprecedented acquisition of knowledge and power that puts us in a real critical position. If you look at human ethics, when you talk about space-time research and what governments are doing, a lot of people like to say, you know, there's a clear recognition of the principle that says, hey, greater knowledge and power brings us a greater need for moral responsibility, serves as a key foundation. Until recently, the human society on this planet does pretty good. The human capacity for moral reasoning has kept pace with the developments in human knowledge and its capacities. But now when we look at time control, and this is my message to your podcast listeners, with this new era in time control, time travel, time research, the gap between moral reasoning and our technological capacities has reached a critical point, and it's greatly exceeded our capacity as a society right now for ethical thinking to responsibly manage that. And what's happening now, and I brought up, as you know, I went dark for a period of time. I came back, and then I went dark after the China thing, because right now the governments around the world are now starting to hide and sequester and essentially start a time control arms race with each other. I throw out that word sometimes, time war, but there is a race to militarize and weaponize this technology or use it for the political, economical, or business gains of different governments and parts of society.
Well, this is a very interesting, because this answers or addresses one of the questions one of my friends who you're familiar with, Hillary Ramo, had asked about the military implications of this, and you sort of just asked that or answered that. But the first thing I want to ask you, are the breakthroughs you mentioned or alluded to, are those, were you referring to breakthroughs in connection to time control or just breakthroughs in total with everything that's going on? You're referring to breakthroughs in technology.
Oh, the technology. For the listeners, it amazes me when people ask me, what are the basics? Is this really happening? It's gone so far past there. It absolutely amazes me. People are packaging the technology into applications and products that are more restricted for government use and some private applications. The technology is being packaged and put into products. This is way past. Is it happening? Is it not happening?
You're talking about using time technology, correct?
Time control technology, yes.
Okay, so it's stuff we don't necessarily see.
It's stuff that's not necessarily seen. The governments are getting real recluse. Now, I got to tell you one thing. After China put their ban on, like I said, I don't know if you know, I've probably made about a dozen trips into China, at least a dozen, and I've done presentations and I've done met with different enterprises, different research centers, the Ministry of Defense, the People's Congress. We've talked about it. We've even collaborated on a light level. When they started recruiting, it was clear that they were trying to buy information and assets and mostly people from around the world to drive their initiative. Once they hit that point, Peter, they closed all communications, and there's severe penalties, which kind of saddens me because there's a lot of really good scientists and philosophers within China who see the good in the research. But unfortunately, for the last 2 years, my communications with China has been relatively low, so I cannot comment to you on what's happening there in the last 2 years.
How well did you learn the Chinese language?
Not at all.
Well, you learned. I know you gave a talk in Chinese once. I had a dream of it, and you said you were actually preparing to talk to someone.
Oh, it's one thing. It's one thing to do a technical presentation. As you know, you've seen me. I've done presentations in Romanian too, and a couple other languages. But it's one thing to do a technical presentation. It's funny. I can walk out of a technical presentation speaking one language, and I can't have a conversation with a 10-year-old child on the street. So. My Chinese is not that, just barely survivable.
Okay, well, that's all very interesting. Now, when you mention the technology of time, I want to ask you something. Now, you're familiar, of course, with Google Earth. Now, one of my friends, my Qigong instructor, Roosevelt Ganey, had an experience once. He was on the Internet with his daughter with Google Earth. And he went into what's called real Google Earth. He was actually seeing what was over his apartment live.
Yeah.
In other words, he tapped into something he wasn't supposed to tap into. There was a live Google Earth. Now,
very interesting.
Yeah, you may or may not be familiar with either that or some other. I mean, I don't know that it was called Google Earth, but it must have been. But I'm going to ask you about a concept here. This is related to not only Google Earth, but a real Google Earth. And let's call it Google Time, where you can go and how does that construct as a computer, Google Time, parlay into the technology that you know? Now, you don't have to tell me that you already have that. Just tell me how would the technology that you know and are familiar with facilitate such a concept as Google Time? Where you could go to any time and see it, you know.
Well, there's danger with that. It comes back to the comment about, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And you know, the application, you know, there's a lot of discussions, you know, after the academic lectures in this community. Most of the dinner conversations turn towards philosophy and the ethics of the application of the technology. Of course, with the advent of a time warp field and a time reactor, the ability to view view different places in time is very, very possible. But there are impacts that come with that, with the sharing of information. You know, give you an example.
Excuse me, just in viewing it?
Just in viewing it. You know, for example, time control from a government perspective, even governments get involved in this discussion, Peter. You'd be surprised. They are afraid of and they want to viciously control and restrict and compartmentalize this information. For example, there's a lot of government leaders who worry that, say, you have a team that is viewing and documenting different places in time, travels back in time to a place in time that's the origin of an existing, say, religion, and it shows that the basis of that religion is false. It could induce religious riots that explode out of the ability of the federal governments to control them. The same is true of national conflicts. If you look at our history that we accept today in many cultures around the world, it's the fact is told by the victor. You know, a factual look at, you know, World War I and II might appear much differently than told today, for example. So the ability to view is a very important tool. a lot of people say, you know, the first thought process is usually, hey, by viewing and not interacting, we have the ability to learn more. That's true, but there are some deeply held views that shape our cultures and society today that could be shattered. And what is the social impact on that is, you know, a point people do consider. And they actually use that as a basis for one of the reasons they want to control and restrict the technology and its application to prevent public riots.
So, okay, so we're talking about potentials. Like when we look at these light cones, all the potentials in the future, we're also looking at all the potentials of past events.
That is correct, yes.
It very much relates to that. So one is actually sort of, you know, it's like somebody's got a thumb in the dike, so to speak, as far as like, you know, it's a sticky wicket to change anything. So then there becomes a political issue about who's going to control what. And so if there are other people, like, so who is the police force here? In other words, you've got your own institute. I don't know who you have to answer to, et cetera, and who these other people have to answer to. But how does that work? In other words, you want, I know you said you want a moral compass, but what is enforcement? How can you could do things on your own, I'm sure, at night if you wanted to. But what is the natural policing action on this sort of thing?
Well, you know, unfortunately, from a government perspective, in any nation, regardless of the culture, there's two magic rules that seem to guide all those discussions we have. You know, it's a nation's and the governments of nations' responsibility for that nation to survive and prosper. They see time control technology as a threat and an opportunity to create an advantage, whether it be weaponized, economic, or otherwise. You know, how do you know, we have a lot of ideas. We talk about this a lot. As we look at the growing options in time control science and in time control technology, the options that they're providing us, it really could affect our very concept of what it means to be human. So it's real conceivable that if the human race uses this newly found knowledge and science skillfully, it could help foster a really greater sense of unity with each other in life as a whole. And we all become part of the same dynamic web of information and energy, like we've always talked before. But many people, and including myself, become worried about the short and long-term consequences of the application of this time control technology. I know you're asking me the question about how do you control it, but I'd like to set the problem up even a little bit more. The gulf now, you know, and I spend a lot of time. I don't spend my time in television studios doing lectures day and night, but I live with the scientific community, the experts all around the world that know about this. And the gulf between the scientific community and the general public may be caused in part by the lack of transparency of these governments and all these organizations develop it. And so that puts the onus on the scientific community, both to demonstrate that there are no long-term negative consequences in using this technology and to adopt a complete transparency. So one part of the answer to your question, Peter, is the governments and the research institutes in the middle of this who are really making the leaps forward in China, in India, in South Korea and Russia and the U.S. They need to adopt complete transparency on all the possible implications that these technologies may have for individuals, the human race, and even this reality. And I don't say that lightly, and this reality, and transparency to every detail of how they're using it. When you look at the tremendous pace of development in this area, it's urgent now to refine, completely revisit and redefine and refine our capacity for moral reasoning so we're equipped to address the moral challenges of this new situation. Again, a technology that can define what it means to be human and what reality is. So we can't wait for a series of responses to emerge in an organic way. We have to confront the reality of our potential future and past and tackle the problems directly. And one of the things we've talked about, and I promote, is that we should be looking at this not from individuals, private institutions, governments. We need, as a group of people evolved and around this and influencing it, examine these questions and risks from a perspective of global ethics that's grounded in the recognition of human values that transcend religion and science and national borders.
I understand, you know, this. I understand this, and you've said this many times before.
Yeah, and what it leads to, Peter, is, you know, that I'm a big proponent of, you know, we need an educational imperative. We need an educational imperative. We need a World Time Council that has authority. The problem is, I've always been a fan of a World Time Council that includes not only national and academic leaders, but spiritual leaders from around the world. The problem is, as this technology advances, it's getting harder and harder. So transparency, and this is what the scientists want, by the way. The scientists doing the greatest work, all they want is transparency, wherever that leads. They want full transparency, full disclosure, and let their communities and their experts, whether they be spiritual leaders, academic leaders, political leaders, open up the discussions to shape this. But that's a really hard hurdle to overcome.
Okay, this is a good point for us to have a little break, so we can we'll have a little break now, and then we'll come back. We got off to a good first inning here.
Okay.
The moon goes round.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Lusa.
So this is part two of podcast number 8 with Dr. David Anderson. Now, I wanted to, with reference to what you were just saying, about what you're actually talking about is redefining politics, because politics is all about control. Although it's very interesting that in the etymology of politics is the same phonetics as polite, and politics sometimes defines what is polite, and politeness sometimes defines what politics are. But the point is, when you're talking, the way you're talking about setting up a time council, but you're actually talking about not only redefining the rhetoric of politics, but redefining politics and how it is approached as a what's that word you lose, a global dynamic matrix. And this is very interesting because, yes, this is the way something would evolve naturally and organically in a world that is what you might call somewhat divinely inspired, instead of so much of the opposite that we have. So what I'm going to ask you here is, can the time control technology actually be used to redefine? I'm not talking about having forums. I mean, that helps. But I'm talking about using it as a fulcrum point to actually change the political viewpoint and political climate of the world that we live in.
Boy, that is a deep question. I think this technology, when you start talking about a technology that has the ability to shape what our definition of reality is and to reshape what it means to be humans, it's different than other technologies. And with that might put pressure on the government, you know. So, you know, disclosure has historically always shown to put extreme pressure on the government to drive results. You add that to the pressure of a life, a human definition and reality changing technology, it may have that opportunity to knock down some of those political barriers and political borders to advance improvement for human society.
Well, in a way, I sort of answered, or you might have already answered my question, because you mentioned earlier that these people were using time control as a tool of warfare. So in other words, they're already competing in these war games, these time, they're not war in the conventional sense of using, you know, weapons and this sort of thing, the typical weapons we think of. It's more of subtle changes. And if you say they're packaging products, you've opened up some corridors for my thinking.
An example that hits me close to home is look at the political reaction and the government's reaction to me filing a full disclosure with an open patent summary on the time reactor. The first reaction was the patent was seized and it was sequestered. The attempts to get disclosure and to accomplish what you want and to affect change in the political and global environment is something that's the heart of many people beyond myself in this area of research. But it is a hard road. But it's a road that history shows can be won if people keep sticking to the guns. The question is, how much pain do we go through to get there?
Well, it did remain up there for a little while, I think, until maybe they figured out what it was. I do recall seeing it in some form or another up there on the patent rolls. And I know that my friend Joseph Matheny had filed patents, and Google patents, you can find them. They tie into what he called his meta machine, but they're so abstract and obtuse that, you know, you might be challenged. And I consider you a genius when it comes to engineering and whatnot. You might be challenged to understand them, or certainly have to pay attention to what the heck he's saying, because they're abstract and obtuse, but they're nevertheless patents. That's another way to yours was very straightforward and simple, what you had there. Now I'm going to ask you a question, and this is sort of a question from a general science viewpoint. Is you mentioned that so much information is coming that governments cannot easily process this information or evaluate it. In other words, it's a bottleneck. You understand what I'm saying? All this technology. They can't keep up with the technology. It's hard for just an individual like myself to keep up with all the things that are emerging, whether they be emerging on Wall Street, whether they be emerging in the technological realm or in societal trends. I don't even try to, you know, I'll sort of see what comes down the pike. I'm not trying hard to figure out the new things myself, but they do come down the pike. But what I'm saying is when you have a bottleneck in nature, like your background is more hard science than the natural sciences, but what happens in nature when there's a bottleneck on an organ, on a life dynamic process? What happens? I'm asking sort of live, you know?
Yeah, and many times the bottleneck will hold for a while and eventually will break loose with consequences that are unsuspected, unexpected, and undesired, and not good.
Well, yes, and this is what I was thinking. It might be in your own interest to look at what happens to bottlenecks in nature on a biological level. Because
I see your point. That's an interesting point to use that as a model. It wouldn't be the first time that science has learned a lot about hard science processes and approaches by studying what happens in nature. Absolutely.
Yes, because life, I mean, you know, how DNA works, and they you know, and sometimes actually you can actually use the, as I say, I'm introducing biology in here because biology is a paradigm, and we're all living, biology is life, it's the study of life, and so time control does fit into, you know, you're talking about the human resonance with this. So if you study the dynamic way of how life and disease interacts, it's going to mimic the political situations that you're dealing with in terms of disease, because...
Well, the scary thing is tying back to our research, which I know you're aware of. I'm not sure if your listeners are. There have probably been maybe about five great advancements by my team. And one of them was after the second time reactor was brought online, our brothers and sisters experience. So brothers and sisters experiment where...
Talking about plants.
We were talking about plants where we actually changed the DNA outside of the test environment by putting by affecting a change through a time reactor. So literally, we're, you know, in a typical scientific environment, you're looking at your test chamber, and by doing things in our test chamber, we actually affected changes in the DNA of organisms that were outside of the actual test elements in there. So we're talking about technology that can change reality. So here we are observing a process. This is why the remote viewing, if you will, through different places in time is a risk. You know, we're here sitting here studying, and we weren't sure what to expect on this, but it was a major discovery to actually affect the makeup of a biological organism at the DNA level as a byproduct or ripple effect of something that happens somewhere else in a test chamber is changing the construct of reality. And doing that without understanding the consequences is where the risk comes in.
Well, yes, and when you mention remote viewing, because I know you were talking about it through looking actually through a scientific device, so to speak, remote viewing through a scientific device. There was also a mention in one of your earlier interviews that you mentioned having some contact it was either Russia or the Moscow Aviation Institute with the remote viewing community there. Can you tell us anything? This is sort of a side question.
Yeah, this was a very special point in a place in my life, I should say. When the Soviet Union was going through its challenges and things got very difficult in the country, the Moscow Aviation Institute was preparing to close, and we were and actually the race in the scientific community was to protect all the great work. The first thing I say about the Moscow Aviation Institute is what I like about them. They have what I consider to be the ideal research environment, where it's not based in hard science, but it's based you sometimes don't know when you're in when you're in the Moscow Aviation Institute, are you in a Buddhist temple? Are you in a clean room in an advanced scientific facility, you know, somewhere in the United States? And there's a blend of both. They didn't draw a line. They see hard science as one path. And whether it be biological, like you say, and by the way, I heard what you said, and I'll be doing some homework on that to see what we can learn about studying biological systems and parallels. But that was the first thing. The second thing was when the Soviet Union did fall and begin their big changes, there was a lot of trying to protect that. And what I admired that most about the Moscow Aviation Institute.
So what you're basically saying is that the remote viewing they did was a part of their scientific
Oh, absolutely. If you were to walk into the Moscow Aviation Institute, you would see them treating space communication systems, say for example, a new rocket propulsion systems and space vehicle propulsion systems. And right next to that, you would see an equal serious level of research on levitation research, on time control research, on remote viewing research, telekinesis research. They didn't have the stereotypes, and they didn't limit their thinking to only just the scientific definition and what's considered acceptable and achievable today within the textbooks.
Oh, and this is...
It'd be like walking into NASA, Peter, and walking into NASA's remote viewing lab and seeing NASA's remote viewing presentations and levitation experiments and so on.
Well, we couldn't take it seriously in terms of what we were fed by the press.
Yes.
I mean,
that's the sad part about our culture, and that's why India is so successful in this area of research, because their culture accepts those things.
Well, the one thing I would tell you, and this is a big part of my research, has been the hidden occult aspects of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which runs NASA, and the founder of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, Jack Parsons. And, you know, I was friends with his wife. You know, it's kind of like there's a whole occult underground in the United States, and, you know, and Jet Propulsion is laboratory is headquarters. And so it really tickled me when we had this wonderful gentleman, Ravi, from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory lecturing to the Romanians in Atlanticron. You know, with the Mars rover hookup, remember?
Yes.
And I just didn't have the heart to get up and ask him about, tell him who I was and what I was doing in Romania. Because, you know, that was like practically, with a couple of exceptions, the only American there. So, you know, it's like, what are you doing there?
That was actually so kind of NASA on the landing of the Mars rover to set up that special presentation for that group of children in Eastern Europe. That was just amazing on their part. And you're right, it probably wouldn't have been the right forum to drop that in. But, your work in Romania, I follow as much as I can what you're doing. One of the other things I'd tell you, asked me a question, a little bit of flashback here. Another thing I'd tell your podcast listeners, the application of time control, not the first time in the history of this planet that time control has been applied. And actually, your research in Romania has taken you to some interesting places where some of our scientists believe that even the work we're doing now with time reactors, we actually believe potentially, we have a theory, that a time reactor was actually fired up in Romania or discharged, just to say discharged, it could have been from a space-based orbit, was discharged in Romania a couple hundred or a couple thousand years ago, very near the research sites that you've been doing.
Could it have been more recently than a couple hundred years ago?
Well, what was interesting about it is a lot of your podcast listeners might not know about time reactors, but you have a discharge of space-time motive force from up high in the space-time structure of the space around the Earth down to the Earth's mass itself. And when you have that, you have a great amount of energy. And the reason we know it was a couple hundred or a couple thousand years ago was because of its position in the sedimentary layer. It was clear that there was no natural occurrence. And this is in the area of Chioclavina Cave, which you may know better than I do. But it actually created different elements and crystals, exotic elements and crystals there that could not be formed naturally by any explanation in the sedimentary layer. Maybe,
okay, so you're saying that
much
the,
deeper.
So you're saying that what the discharge shows up in the sedimentary layer as opposed
is yeah, to, the, to,
go ahead.
Exactly. The exotic materials, there's three or four of them, are present in the sedimentary layer where they can't exist.
Now,
they literally can't exist.
Would those facilitate the continuous or further bending of space-time as they exist now?
There's a two-part answer to that. The first part is when you discharge, when you tap into space-time motive force and you have that discharge, you can have a byproduct where you change the geology or the mineral structure around the discharge point. You also have points on the Earth's surface that are more susceptible to more easily opening a space-time motive force discharge at that point versus others.
Well, I want to say something, and this is also for the benefit of the listeners. The cave you mentioned, Chioclavina Cave, is how you say it. Chioclavina? Chioclavina. By great serendipity, I was there last August 14th. This is during the famous biorhythm of the Philadelphia Montauk projects. And the reason I was there is I didn't say we're going to go to this cave. I didn't know about this cave. I was kind of told we were going. We had a group of us that included, it was a little group of us, and the people that had come with me to Atlanticron, Joan Roth and Alan Hutchins. And we went because there was an archaeologist. His name is Danielle, and he is the archaeologist of this area in Transylvania, well, all of Romania. But he focuses on Transylvania. He's purchased a drone where he goes around and does the whole area and surveys it. And many of the stories I told him from the books that I published from Radu Sinemar, he says, these stories line up with what I've heard. I could go through those valleys of Transylvania in this general area and just take story after story if I could get the people to talk. And they would talk eventually, but I could do that for the rest of my life and tell interesting stories. However, what he took us to this cave and explained to us that this had the highest, largest amount of deposit of bat guano, and that the dictator Ceausescu built a road there because he used the bat guano and the sediment and whatnot, what it had mixed with, for the explosives industry and for selling it for military purposes. But this cave crosses with seven other caves. It is a literal conduit to the inner earth, as is most of the caves in Transylvania. They go so deep, you can't follow them. But what this is particularly interesting to me, not only was I there, but, and there are stories of giants being there, all sorts of incredible legends and myths of the area, but this is so symbolic of this book I wrote, The White Bat, which is, I was having dreams of going to Transylvania way 1989, when you were still doing your time research. Well, I wasn't doing time research then. I hadn't even met Preston Nichols at that point. So my dreams were talking to me in a very mysterious and delightful way. And it seems somehow that, I don't know when that discharge occurred or what its residual effects are, but I think it's very important that you read the last chapter of this book, The Secret Parchment, that talks about that area. I will send it to you. You have the book. I don't know if you have it in your office right now, but I will send you the chapter so you might appreciate it, because this was all facilitated by huge gold tunnels underneath this area, tunnels of pure gold in the general area.
And, you know, and this is just a third dimension, Peter. You know, when I look at what you've done, like I know you've been up in Sarmizegetuja, you've done a lot of research in that part of Romania. I know you've been throughout the Carpathian Mountains. The Cioclovina Cave is in the southern Carpathians, which isn't too far from where you're in. For me, it's an interesting synchronicity. You know, me, again, being a little more grounded and limited in the hard science, I can't speculate about the ties to a Cioclovina Cave, but it is clear there are exotic materials. There are minerals like berlinite, ALPO4, hydroxylelestadite, there that occur that can only be created from high temperatures that can't exist in that sedimentary layer or be created in that sedimentary layer. So this is a scientific anomaly generated by great heat or a great energy discharge that's totally separate from your books and your reading. But I do try to keep up with what you're doing, and I do have that book, and I'll try to give it a good read and see what
I'll send you an email on where to read it. But it's funny that just at the same time you told me this, I got a call from this geophysicist who I know on Long Island, who is involved in all sorts of secret type of stuff. And he said there's a high concentration. I don't know if it's exactly these substances, but it's something very similar near Colorado Springs in the Air Force Academy, in that general area. It's like the Air Force Academy. The old Tesla had a lab there. So it's not an accident that some of these situations. But if you ever want to get you eventually arranged for me to do a tour of Romania back in 2008. I could give you a much more extensive one if you ever have the time or opportunity.
I think you're absolutely correct about that.
So anyway, I want to ask you now about the time tremor detector. Now, if you could just refresh the audience on what a time tremor detector is and how, you know, is it bigger than a bread box? How big is it? What is it actually in terms of its physicality, and how does it interrelate with a time reactor or extend from a time reactor?
Okay, well, just one clarification. We abbreviated TTD. Many people call it time tremor detector. It's actually a temporal tremor detector. It has a very simple purpose. It is a system that was designed and put into space-based orbit that can monitor the surface of the Earth and detect when a temporal distortion is created. Let's just say it that way. So say, for example, if somebody were to fire up a time reactor, if somebody was to fire up a high-power quantum tunneling device, this is a temporal tremor detector that is exactly that. It's detecting a small tremor or a variation in space-time. So it means it's a detector that detects when space-time is being manipulated on a relatively low level from orbit.
Okay, and you say it's from orbit?
Yeah, we tried to implement a system from Earth's surface-based facilities. It just doesn't work. It's so much easier, so much lower power, and so much more accurate and efficient from orbit.
Well, that's good to know, because in the movie I did at the camp at Atlanticron, we were using walkie-talkies for temporal tremor detectors.
Hey, by the way, it's no different than sensing nuclear reactors. It's just a different type of sensing technology.
Okay. Now, so you were actually able to use this technology to kind of say, hey, you're doing experiments there in a particular country and get their attention? Is that how you got certain people's attention?
Well, we were principal in the development of that technology. We led the development of that technology, and unfortunately, we cannot say everywhere it's being applied. But the answer to your question is yes, it could definitely be used for that.
And now, so this leads to something else. When you're doing time research and time experiment, and I want to remind the audience that what you said is what the government will tell you or the secret sector will tell you is that things are always developed at least 15 years ahead of where the public has a clue. Preston used to say 20 to 30 years. But in any case, I just want to keep that in mind when I ask you this next question, is when you start using a technology like the temporal tremor detector, it's sort of like you're going to come into contact at some point with like what you call a bigger fish that swims in across into your zone of influence. Can you tell us anything in your own experiences? I mean, because what you're doing is very groundbreaking, and you must have felt very much alone at certain times in your life and development of this technology. And I'm not talking about bigger fish in terms of governments that are more powerful. I'm talking about time, people that understand time or beings that understand time that might be, in other words, you go into a bigger arena where you meet the, like Captain Kirk on Star Trek seeing something. They put him in his place or something. Do you ever have any experience?
Well, when you talk there's always a story out there about one of the reasons the government wants to cover this up because the governments aren't really in control. It's really the time travelers that are controlling the government in exchange for other things. The short answer to that is no. I've met some really great scientists, really great philosophers. I've met some really great spiritual leaders that have a lot of views on the subject. I haven't had an encounter with otherworldly or other space-time beings from other dimensions. Not yet.
And I didn't even mean it in that context. Just somebody that, that might have known more that, get back in line, Anderson. It might not come in the form of, I wasn't alluding to aliens or anything like that.
Yeah. But there's a lot of pressure. There's no doubt. I remember we spoke about 2.5 years ago, and I was talking about the India's Ministry of Science and Technology and their Maharashtra facility. They had a room full of commercialized products using time warp fields. For time control application, for medical research, scientific research, and health treatment, and they had so much pressure, they just closed it. They just closed all the doors. They have rooms full of products ready to be commercialized, but the pressure not to discuss these things is just stifling all that.
And that came from a component of the Indian government, I believe you said.
Yeah, actually, India had a very, and still to this day, they actually have a, I can't remember the words you were using, the Indian government, beautiful culture, some of the best minds in space-time research there, but they have two wings of their government, the Ministry of Science and Technology in New Delhi, and they have the Research and Analysis Wing, which is a separate arm of the government, which is essentially their foreign intelligence agency. And they even keep secrets from their parliament, and they both started separate, compartmentalized, no sharing of information time research development efforts. And so it's very complicated there, very beautiful but very complicated at the same time. They're competing inside their own government with themselves.
All right. Now, that's good. Now, I'm going to shift the we still have a few minutes in this segment, but I'm going to shift this to a – I want to talk about the – as this relates, the technology that you've learned, and the reason I want to do this is relates to the Montauk Project and the Philadelphia Experiment. And the reason I want to address this is I recently did this newsletter, which you read, explaining light cones and time-like curves. All of a sudden, my IQ on the subject of time went way up. I've had and the opportunity to learn from Preston Nichols certain things. But Preston Nichols always said, he said, this is all a dream. He says, he never promised that he could recreate the Montauk Project or something like it. He has his share of strange experiences, but where he might think that he went in time or talks to himself from the future, but he never sort of came forward with anything like you're coming forward with. He had a much higher, which I call weird quotient, as far as the weird phenomena or the paranormal phenomena than you offer, at least, you don't offer it publicly if you've had anything, and that's understandable. But what I wanted to ask with regards to, it became very apparent to me that the Montauk Project and Philadelphia Experiment, compared to what the technology that you brought forth, is sort of like surgery in a barbershop chair in the Old West, is what they were doing.
In one way, yeah, and there's another thing that I always admired about it, is that it kind of goes back to the conversation you led into about Russia and the Moscow Aviation Institute. In one way, yeah, it might seem a little cruder looking back with a less understanding, but at the same time, they were mixing the application of hard science and technology with the influence and capacities of the human mind, which put them well ahead of probably or on par with the Moscow Aviation Institute.
Well, this is a very key component of the Montauk Project. Because if I've been rereading that book for two reasons, and one of the reasons is it's been translated into Spanish, and so I'll be releasing the Montauk Project book in the Spanish language very soon. It should be by August, it should be ready of this year. But in any case, as I reread the material that I originally wrote over 24 years ago, I'm saying, oh. He talks about the electromagnetic bottle technology, which is your self-contained field. And he says, this technology is all secret. I've signed a 30-year agreement, which might come up in a few years, be expired. He says, I can't talk about that. But he says, first off, you're talking about the curvature of space-time. He's talking about an electronic or electromagnetic pulse actually bending time and amping it way up with these amplitrons, Klystron tubes. What do you have to say about that avenue of literally getting a bend space-time, if that's the right word to term to use?
Well, the first time is one of our greatest achievements and one of our greatest embarrassments. If you remember, back in the 1980s, we were seeing some unusual things, and then all of a sudden in the early 1990s, we thought we had free energy. We were using these magnetic pulses and chemical reactions in inducing these time warp fields. And, we thought we were creating energy from nothing. And to our embarrassment, it took almost, 8.5, 9.5 years. And we finally realized we weren't creating energy. We were just tapping into energy that already exists around the Earth. It's naturally occurring energy. We were tapping into it. So it kind of goes back to the limitation of our senses. We kind of shrink the world down to only what our limited senses can see and perceive. But every now and then we get lucky like we did, and we realized, hey, we aren't creating energy. We're just tapping into energy that exists in a natural
this
form.
This is an important statement you just made, because I have a question about this. When you were your first generation of the time reactor was very low grade compared to where you've developed it to now. So, but you always mentioned it was a chemical reagent with laser array and a low grade electromagnetic rotating field.
Yes.
Now, how did you? I mean, are you doing much curvature? Are you able to tap? I mean, how? What is the real key to that rotation? What is it that actually gets the space time curve and gets that link into the you're actually accelerating time in that field, correct, or decelerating?
Well, you're creating fields of closed time-like curves that allow you basically either to accelerate time in a forward direction or move backwards in time at sublight speeds, which is key. But essentially, if you look at curved space-time, there are two components of it for your podcast listeners here. There's two components. The first, I always like to say when I'm talking to college students, go out into the middle of space and just put a mass there. Space-time is going to curve around it. And that's one element of curved space-time. But there's another one. If you take that mass and you spin it, that flexible yet rigid space-time will actually bend. And what we call that is inertial frame dragging. And essentially, if you have an Earth spinning in space or any other mass spinning in space, you're actually bending space-time around it like a spring, but with enormous potential energy. And what would happen if you removed the Earth, that inertial frame dragging, that curved space-time would spring. So you essentially have in essence, potential energy stored in a spring around curved space-time. To give you an idea, and I'll try to shorten this up real quick, to give you an idea, if over 1,000 years we slowed the Earth's rotations by 7/1,000ths of a second to harvest that space-time motive force stored around the Earth, it would be the same as a 50-megawatt power-generating plant operating for 23,000 years for 7/10,000ths of a second, slowing the Earth over 1,000 years. The potential energy, and that's it's no different than a waterfall. You know, it's amazing to me, and it surprises me when I talk to professors and college students. You know, you have a waterfall flowing down. You have potential energy. You harvest it for hydroelectric. You have tidal forces. You harvest it. You have heat. You harvest it. Well, around the Earth is the largest source of clean energy stored in the within the curved space-time due to the inertial frame dragging. And we don't recognize that and don't look it away because, again, you know, it's something we don't see. So we tend to dismiss it in the scientific community.
Well, I would advise people to look at your YouTubes on that subject of harvesting energy. That you explain that all the statistics in that very clearly. Now, but when you had your initial first generation of the time reactor, you were actually able to tap. Were you actually tapping into the closed time-like curves of the Earth with that?
Well, you have to remember that essentially inertial frame dragging is the twisting of space-time.
Right.
And when you discharge it over a great distance, what you're doing is taking curved space-time and concentrating it in a reactor chamber. And when you do that, you create fields of closed time-like curves, just like in your article explains. That's all it is. All it is when we labeled that space-time motive force, that potential energy that's stored in the inertial frame dragging around the Earth, and we would discharge it, all you get is a field of closed time-like curves that you can control to a pretty high degree today. And by doing that, you can do anything you can do with closed time-like curves.
So were you creating the discharge with this first generation?
Oh, we thought we tapped. We solved the free energy thing, Peter. It was kind of funny, and it did take us a long time. If you remember, it was almost a decade for us to realize that we weren't creating free energy. We were just harvesting a natural energy source that exists on our planet and around our planet.
So even the small version is tying into that.
Yes, all the versions of the time reactor. Basically, if we were on a mass on a planet in space that wasn't rotating, a time reactor would not function.
Now, this is relevant to another question from a friend of mine, Brendan Humphreys, who is a disciple of Bruce Cathy. I don't mean that in a religious sense. Bruce Cathy was an airline pilot who set up a whole grid system of the Earth. I don't know if you're familiar with Bruce Cathy. He's passed away now. He was a New Zealander.
Yeah, I'm not familiar, no.
Okay, he's very well known. David Childress published many of his books, but he basically figured out the whole Earth as on these whole harmonics, and he was being pursued by intelligence agencies and whatnot. But he talked about the Earth as a time machine. I kind of studied a little bit of words, and I said, the Earth is a time machine. And this is one of Brendan's questions, was what about the Earth as a time machine? The Earth as a time machine itself.
Well, just the fact that the answer is yes, and there's many different answers to that question along many different paths. First off, you know, the Earth is moving at different relative speeds of other bodies, you know, in the universe, and by default that makes it basically, you know, a time machine, a machine that, you know, an object that is where time is passing at a different rate than other places. The fact that it has its rotating is key, because when you have a rotating mass, you have inertial frame dragging, and then you have basically a natural phenomenon that can be used to create concentrated fields of closed time-like curves that allow you to manipulate time, to accelerate or decelerate or reverse time. So the answer is the natural phenomenon occurs. The one debate we have internally all the time is, could a natural phenomenon trigger a discharge of space-time motive force to create some type of, you know, time variation or distortion that we don't yet have a published opinion on?
Well, his next question was about human consciousness, which takes us back to the Montauk Project. But before I address that, and we'll address that in the next segment, as we wrap up this segment here, back to what I was saying about the – so in effect, the electromagnetic pulse that Preston is talking about in the Montauk Project is in effect what you affected with this early version of the time –
It could have been the same. I can't comment on, being that I wasn't there, I can't comment on what they did, if it was similar to what we were doing. Obviously, we've advanced a lot of elements. I just really don't know how to reply to that, Peter, because
I
wasn't there.
But
I do agree with your comment before, is that we use rotating electromagnetic fields. We use a chemical reagent that's initiated with a very high energy pulse generated by lasers. That's a standard blueprint of our time reactor, even in the early prototypes.
But you wouldn't disagree that an electromagnetic pulse, if strong enough, could basically create a curve in space-time.
If it created a discharge of space-time motive force, absolutely it could. And you know how I am, Peter. I do believe, and why I'm a hard scientist, I never dismiss that there are many other ways that people could transcend time. And there are a lot of people who laugh at us for the idea that we want to use science and technology to transcend time, when they believe every human being has the capability within their mind and their consciousness to do it with their mind alone. So there are many different ways, and perhaps Montauk was doing it the same way we were, or an earlier variant, I don't know.
All right, well, we'll wrap up this segment with that, and then we'll start with a new segment, and I'll be asking more about the paradigms of the Philadelphia and Montauk Project.
Okay.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
All right, so this is part three of podcast number 8 with Dr. David Anderson. And I wanted to, in this segment, start with the human consciousness factor with regard to time control technology. And first I'm going to start with the Philadelphia Experiment and the Montauk Project, particularly the Philadelphia Experiment, as the stories. And so much of these things that come down as stories and mythology, I've had enough experience with people who were peripherally associated with these events or phenomena to, if I had to bet on whether this project occurred or not, yes, I would definitely bet on it if I had to bet one way or the other. But anyway, in the Philadelphia Experiment, we have reports of spontaneous combustion, we have mental disorientation, we have people being amalgamated into the bulkheads of the ship. Horror, absolute horror, this is why I liken those early experiments to surgery in a barbershop chair. And you, in your work, you seem to have none of the accompanying trauma associated with that project in particular, and also with the fallout from the Montauk project. Do you have any comment on that?
Yeah, Peter, if we were talking 20 years ago, back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I would have, in the research we've been doing, I would have had a hard time accepting some of those horrific impacts of the Philadelphia experiment. With what I've seen now, absolutely, I don't put anything aside. There are a lot of risks and dangers associated with the application of this technologies. There's hazardous environments, not even to say, you know, what the hazardous implications are of simply using it. You know, you talked about consciousness. You're talking about the ability of one exercising time reactor to phase people in and out of existence, to alter the structure of DNA outside of the actual test environment and facility. Just physically, the concept of physically moving somebody through space and time into a bulkhead is one horrific application or consideration. But the idea of phasing somebody out of existence or changing their genetic makeup or consciousness is another one equally horrifying.
Well, yes, and well, I'm saying, but you have, well, we'll get this in a bit, but there have been pictures of, say, like in a tornado, where a piece of straw will be embedded in a glass, or a car will be embedded into a wall.
Sure.
That they've tried to explain this away in more normal terms. What do you have to say about such phenomena like that as a scientist?
As a scientist, I'd probably say I'm not qualified to really comment on it. But within this world, the world I know, the potential use and misuse of this, of what's coming out of the laboratories now, and what's being done is beyond the comprehension of most people.
All right. Now, another part that I wanted to ask you about the Montauk Project is that the whole...
I apologize, Peter, too. I don't feel like I'm answering your question.
It's fine. It's not really that relevant to the discussion. It's just a point of interest. I thought you might... We're really talking about tornadoes and their potential to literally... Well, I guess really create a closed time-like curve is really what we're getting at. That is Earth energy. And I don't know if we could say if a tornado... is related to space-time motive force, or can tap into it. I don't know. I don't know if you have any comment on that.
My only comment would be not directly in the energy level, even in an F5 tornado is not even measurable compared to the energy in a space-time motive force discharge.
Okay. What I wanted to ask you next is from the book The Montauk Project, and this was the whole genesis of the Montauk Project, or the whole basic idea, was that in the Philadelphia experiment, the people became discombobulated by their exposure to these irregular fields of energy. And it also was apparent to me, in as I studied for this article and wrote it, explaining your work, that if this ship, the USS Eldridge, appeared in Norfolk, Virginia, or in Montauk, New York, these were like very baby journeys in time. In other words, they appeared more in space than they did in time. In other words, they didn't go very far back in time. They just went down the road a few miles in space, and maybe they were a few minutes different. They didn't take huge journeys into time until, according to the story, they were able to tap into the closed time-like curve, if we use the language I've been learning from you, at the Philadelphia and Montauk, and then you had this boom, 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 this big energy going on whereby they were parlaying off of a what you might call a master source of a closed time-like curve, or a master curve, to use very, I guess, haphazard language. But in all of your you talked about seeing a discharge in Romania. Did you ever look or have occasion to see if there were any discharges surrounding Montauk or the Philadelphia Naval Yard?
always been, there were four questions in there, Peter. I'll do my best. You asked me about if people can be affected mentally. There's a lot of, on a biological life form, there's a lot of risk even being around a time reactor. The idea that somebody, you know, in the presence, whether it be in any experiment, near any type of field that's creating of closed time like curves, suspending space and time, it could create everything from confusion to mental impairment to death. There are radiation aspects because of the boundary layer in that. So that's the answer to the first question. And discharges in other places, it's one of the reasons why we were, you know, in the moving forward from this place in time. That's why we focus so hard on the use of temporal tremor detectors, the TTDs, to help us see if anything occurs. And our greatest interest is to ever see if there's something naturally occurring, which we never have observed, only, man-made discharges of space-time motive force. So the short answer to that is no. There's always been that temptation to go back and view those experiments, and that's nothing that has ever been done.
Okay, because again, it's kind of like opening Pandora's box if one were to.
Yes.
Well, thank you. That's a very interesting answer. Now, in the Montauk Project, what the solution was, and the whole sort of genesis of the Montauk Project, and this was, according to the book, figured out by John von Neumann. He said that he studied metaphysics, and he determined, according to what Preston told us, is that people had time references. They were referenced to time, and then when they lost these references, they were discombobulated mentally. Any comment on that?
Of being mentally affected?
But yeah, because they lost their, what von Neumann termed a time reference. Every human being is referenced to time. Well, we kind of logically know this. It's the way our brain works. But,
okay.
Is really a psychological. Go ahead.
Yeah, the short answer is yeah, and I'll try to paint a picture, which is hard on a podcast. But if you imagine a spherical field that's created by, that accelerates or decelerates time. For a biological entity, just imagine if you were half in and half out of that field. What would happen, for example, to your listeners, to your brain, if your brain was right on the boundary layer? Forget the physical world, the physical, the mental aspects. If your brain on the right side of your body was experiencing accelerated time while the brain on the left was experiencing a slower period of time. You're talking about dramatic impacts. The idea that, that can cause death is easy, so the idea that that could cause mental confusion and other symptoms is the same. And that boundary layer, that's the real issue. That's the real issue. What we found is that if somebody can be immersed in a field without having to move through an aggressively changing boundary layer, it can be done safely. If not, it can cause everything you're saying.
Okay, now, what do you do to protect your people in the lab?
Now, that's something we can't answer. And it's proprietary, and I have given my word not to release that, but that is the trick. So basically what we're saying is you have to create a time warp field and a time reactor, create a field around a biological organism without them having to move through a boundary layer with radically different time rates. And
so
that's actually a big part of the work that we've done.
Okay, so this is a very sophisticated extrapolation of the earlier technology to protect the human. So you've taken precautions, and this is the most important. You can't talk about what it is, but you've taken highly evolved technical precautions to protect people.
Yeah, I would say you summarized the key elements of a time reactor very well, the three elements of it earlier. honestly, the basic form of a time reactor hasn't changed since the early 1990s. What's changed is all the control equipment around it and sensing equipment around it to allow the safe use of the technology.
And this is a human interface. We're talking about a human interface. And this is the question I was leading up to with the Montauk Project, is that because of this time reference issue, Preston said the solution was to pump a fake reality into the electromagnetic bottle, into the human being inside the electromagnetic bottle, pumping a fake reality. Now, before I ask you to respond to that, I must say that this fake reality was a justification, correctly or incorrectly, evilly or not evil, for creating this whole schematic of mind control out of which the MKUltra experiments and all this stuff that went down the tubes as far as a moral compass went, but it created a justification for all this mind control technology, some of which was ostensibly used to, as they say, pump a reality into a human being just so he could survive in this environment. The fact that it went sour is a whole other issue. But that is the whole idea. Can you respond to that?
Sure. Where Montauk was really ahead of its time, from what I've read and what I've respected a lot, is that they recognize that they were having trouble controlling the technology using just technology. And when they introduced the element, my first point is when they introduced moving a human mind into the equation, they were able to get better results. That's something we have not done. The second part of that would be improperly doing that could induce all types of problems in any biological entity, no matter what it is, in that environment. So it could cause that kind of harm. Now, we don't do that, but, and you have to look at us as a human society. You know, there are people who think the use of technology to transcend time is ridiculous when we have the power within our human mind. There's hard scientists that would never even consider the idea that the human mind has the ability to transcend time, and there's so many different shades of that around the wheel of those two issues and views that I don't accept any one. I'm grounded in one domain, but I do accept the fact that if you want to understand time, you have to study it from every domain. But specifically, we only focus on the technical aspects of it, and we protect the human mind and biological entities, but we don't put them in the control loop.
So that question I asked there is very important. As you say, it's proprietary. I basically hit a major trigger when I asked that question, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I'd say you hit a trigger, and that's the trick of this technology. It's gone way past, way past, it's been decades now. Way past is it possible. It's been possible. Now the issue is controlling and implying it in a controlled and safe manner.
Because as I read your article, I see, but everything you're doing is not horror driven like the Philadelphia and Montauk projects were. So that you've made a, whether you recognize it or such, you've made a psychological breakthrough.
And I believe that the greatest breakthroughs we will see will be the mix of technology and human consciousness. Some of the greatest achievements that will be realized out of time reactor or other time control technologies, regardless of what they are, some of the greatest achievements will come when it is safe to actually couple consciousness with the control systems in those technologies. And that's going to open a whole new era, the next generation of time control research and space-time research. And you could even call it reality research.
Well, this is sort of like having the proverbial, not antenna on your head, but the helmet the helmet that enables you to basically scope time. But I want to get back to, see, you don't tout yourself as a psychologist. I've never heard you even allude to the fact that you were a psychologist. You seem to understand people very well when they become troublesome or dangerous. You seem to really know your common sense about that sort of thing, the way I watched you interface with people. You seem to understand people in these areas. But what you've dealt with here is a profound psychological tool to help human beings. Can you say anything about your own acumen in psychology in this regard, in this specific regard?
Well, I just believe any individual has a responsibility and obligation to have a positive impact on human society, however they choose to do that. And I am very passionate about it. I'm not sure I know the full answer to that. I also see that being around the technology, if this technology is applied and brought forth in the proper manner, the benefits to human society could be extremely wonderful, extremely wonderful. And I take a lot of responsibility on that. One of my challenges anymore is balancing both worlds and keeping those in check. Actually, I've had quite a difficult time in the last couple of years doing that.
Well, now this makes me ask a question, and we can delete it from the podcast if you want, because we had talked about the prospect of me visiting the lab, and if indeed I did, would I have to be subject to this technology in order to view it?
Could you repeat that, Peter?
Well, I said, would I have
understood.
To be in other words, I said, we discussed the prospect of me visiting the lab, and if I did, I'd obviously have to be protected in some form to actually see it, correct?
Actually, within the boundary of the field, it's very safe. You can walk up within a foot or a half a meter of a time reactor and be fine. It's the only issue of a biological life form moving through a boundary layer. And the reason is time rates change. For your listeners who aren't old school with what we did back in the 1980s, when you hit a layer where time is moving at one rate on another and a much faster rate, say, on the other side or a slower rate, you get Doppler effects that can create very, very harmful radiation. In addition to the fact that time is accelerated at different, moving faster or slower at different points, when you move a biological entity through that, it can create all kinds of havoc on the physical being.
So to actually sit there and watch it is no big deal. It's only if you go inside of the
through the boundary layer inside the field. Other than a lot of visual phenomenon, you wouldn't have any other feelings, any other observations. It's only the boundary layer.
Well, you'd be kind of foolish to be walking through the boundary layer. I mean, we're told what.
Oh yes, absolutely.
But what is the protection? So, I mean, what is the protective? I mean, it almost sounds like the protective is not necessary in under those circumstances. I'm a little bit lost because you mentioned that you had this proprietary technology to protect the people from any adverse effects of the technology. Now, from what you just said, it seems like there's no need for it. I'm a little confused.
Yeah. Well, the nature of a time warp field is you'll have, say, a spherical field, a spherical boundary. On one side of the field, let's say for your podcast listeners, there's time moving as it normally does. On the other side of that sphere, through a small boundary layer, time is moving at a different rate when you initiate a time reactor. Time is moving at a different rate. In that boundary layer, where on one side of the boundary layer time is moving much faster or slower relative to the other side, moving a biological entity through that when those variations exist without protection is a huge risk. It's a huge risk. And
so what you're saying is, okay, so what I'm getting clear. So what you're saying is you actually have a technology that will enable somebody to go through the boundary
layer.
Yes,
absolutely. Oh. And we have ways not only to move people through but to more safely initiate a field around a biological entity. How we do that is very, very, very protected information. But it is possible to initiate a field and have it slowly grow and surround a biological entity. It's also possible to have an existing time reactor field set up where time rates differences are already established and safely move them through a boundary layer with a type of protective field.
Can you tell me, and if you can't answer this, this is fine. Could it or would it involve wearing something that looks something similar to a skin diver's wetsuit?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's completely irrelevant.
Good question, but the answer is no.
Yeah. Okay. So now, if you had somebody in a field, and it was an accelerated field, and it was going to take them back into, let's just say arbitrarily, take them back to 1 year ago, would they have to step through that boundary layer, or could just the acceleration stop and they would arrive at that place? Or would they literally, to travel into time, would they have to literally walk through the boundary layer, or could it just kind of, the acceleration stop and they would arrive there?
It depends on the nature of how the experiment is set up. It's no different than like in your paper. I know a lot of your podcast listeners will look at it, and there you show kind of a variation of a Tipler cylinder where somebody is moving in a spiral pattern around a mass where space has been bent, so they can actually travel backwards in time. And that phenomenon, if you were, say, a ship within a large time warped area of space, you could move backwards in time at speeds below the speed of light and then just leave that field. Or you can create a field around an object in a much smaller scale, of course, of closed time-like curves, and move that object forwards and backwards in time.
So both potentialities, yes. I guess, would
exist. Physically possible. As far as the Tipler cylinder, one hasn't been built yet.
Well, yes. Now, in the case of talking about pumping a fake reality into the human consciousness, which is just such a bizarre thing to even say or do, but fake realities pumped into us with just watching the media or even a movie. It just pumps a reality into your head, or commercials try to do this. But in terms of that sort of technology or that sort of study, that's really not something that your work really touches on, is it?
I would disagree with that on so many points. First off, I talk about our brothers and sisters experience, where we take seedlings with a certain genetic makeup and DNA structure, and when we put them in a time warp field and they're reproducing over some span in time, when they're brought back out, it turns out that those seedlings that were the source of other seedlings that were outside the time warp experimental chamber, DNA structure changed. That is a experiment in changing the construct of reality at the DNA level. That would be point one. Point two, and this is a barrier. I always like to, a lot of people think the scientific method and using insight and the power of the mind are totally divorced. With regards to the changing the structure of reality, I mean, there are religions out there, beliefs like Buddhism, that talk about conventional truth and ultimate truth. They see no disagreement between a scientific method and using insight to search for an ultimate truth based only on insight and meditation. When you said you used some words that I would mildly disagree with when I was in front of students, when you said, I'm trying to think how you said it, you said there was something that we wouldn't see or feel affect that way. But the bottom line is we don't see much of the true universe around us. It's like the quote I have, and I use it all the time. I overuse it, and I started using it about 15 years ago. And for your podcast listeners, there's three important lessons in space-time research. Number one is we don't see our universe the way it is. We see it the way we are. And we have limited senses that see a tiny microscopic part of a very much larger, beautiful macroscopic universe. So when you say we're not experimenting in reality, we actually are. It's just things that we don't see and perceive, but we know they're happening, like through that brothers and sisters. And apologies, that was a little long-winded, but I was a little passionate on that one.
Well, the only thing is that when I read this stuff, what Preston's talking about pumping in a fake reality, it's just there's just a whole lot of, you know, I guess what you'd call computers and cogitations and computations going on. It's like you have a whole, well, this goes into the human side of what's going on with the individual. I mean, maybe we can talk in the next segment about the Montauk Chair, but I want to just digress for a second and ask a question from one of the listeners.
But Peter, can I make one more comment?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Is that okay? When you talk about reality, I talk about the brothers and sisters experiment. Imagine that. Okay, I'll just put yourself in our situation. You're sitting around the test chamber. You put seedlings in, and you regress them backwards in time within the field. And when your experiment is done and you bring them back out, you find out that the genetic record that was the same inside the chamber where you regress the seedlings back in time is now different than the seedlings that were identical outside of the chamber, say, sitting behind you on that table in the laboratory. You've just changed the construct of reality. So the idea that in Montauk that they were experimenting in reality, the answer is anytime you touch time control technology, even on the minimalist level, you are changing the construct of reality. And when you introduce the human consciousness, I'm not qualified to comment on that, but I imagine the impact could be dramatic.
Okay, well, very good answer. Now I'm going to ask, before we end this segment, one of our listeners had asked, has Dr. Anderson ever visited Inner Earth? If so, is there here, how is time manifesting in that kind of space? And maybe I can qualify by that if you can't answer that. If maybe you have visited the Inner Earth, but can you say anything about the Inner Earth for this listener?
No, I cannot say that I've been to the Inner Earth. No, I wish I could, but again, Peter, you know my weakness. I am very laser focused on one particular topic. You could ask me what the most popular show is on TV today, and I couldn't even tell you. So if you ask me about Inner Earth or anything outside of my domain, I am pretty much a fish out of water.
Well, that's the answer I expected, but you know, I do like to. You know,
and my apologies to your listener.
I serve the listeners as well. So anyway, thank you. We'll end this segment, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about the human factor in, you know, vis-a-vis the Montauk Chair paradigm.
Okay.
Run when the rhythm's right. Go into the night. Go until you're out of sight and you're out of my mind. Run when the rhythm's right. Go into the night. Floating as the river flows, easy as it goes to the ocean. So walk on by, I've got no reason to love you, but I do, I do, I do. Show me colors of the sky, but all I see is gray. You lost me when you lied. Promise me that you never try. Secrets in your eyes. You go and run, I'll hide. Show me colors of the sky, but all I see is gray. You lost me when you lied. I don't ever want to be a crown, just another prize. It breaks my heart. Lost in the midnight blue, shadows of the moon. Here with open arms for you, feeling something so new. Said with me you'd reach the sky. Oh, but we were so young. Love me till the summer's done, but keep me in your heart. So I hold on. So walk on by, I've got no
to the ground now. Somehow I feel like you don't know me. Shove me to the ground now. I don't even know how. Brought me to a life that you never showed me.
Coming from a locked out ghost of yourself. But you're coming from the light. There's more to you than you ever thought there was. Yeah, you're coming from the light. Run when the rhythm's right.
We're happy to enhance this podcast with a short interview with our sponsor, our co-sponsor, along with Sky Books, Noosa. And we have here Sky Barbrick, the lead singer and composer for Noosa. And hello, Sky.
Hello, Peter.
It's nice to have you with us. Thank you so much for allowing us to let us use your music in our podcast. Can you tell us a little bit about Noosa and how you got started as a songwriter?
Oh, sure. Well, I started writing songs maybe 4 years ago when I was living in Australia for a fun 5 months. And my first song was a Christmas song that I wrote with a friend. And after that, I was like, wow, I can actually write songs. This is pretty cool. So I got kind of tired of swimming and being on the beach every day. And I was motivated, went back to New York, found a producer that I worked with on 2 albums, Matt Busco. And we made those albums, and it's kind of just magical happenings. One thing led to another, and it's my life.
Well, it's excellent music. We've had a lot of compliments on it, and we're going to be spicing up some more of the podcast with some of your different music. All we've played thus far is Heartache. I know you've had quite an international following. You've been very popular. I know that many record companies have sought you out. Can you tell us why you decided not to go with any record companies and have maintained your independence?
Well, I think eventually a label might be a great fit, but up until, you know, these past few albums, I've remained independent because I really wanted to learn how everything works, writing the song to producing it to publishing it, and even down to licensing for commercials. We do that all ourselves, so it gives me an inside look at what actually happens so I can make good decisions for future releases. And because it's very easy for artists to get taken advantage of in the early stages of their careers, which can be very disheartening and discouraging. So I'm happy with remaining independent.
Well, you've done a very good job with that, both you and Matt, I know. And I wanted to ask you, you put out a vinyl record, and this is kind of a unique thing to do, an actual vinyl, so people can buy it. They can download you from iTunes. They can buy your, I don't know, do you sell CDs, by the way?
No, we never made CDs. All the stuff has been primarily digital until the vinyl came out. And
but you actually put out a record. You actually put out a vinyl record.
Yeah. That's available on the website, and vinyl is becoming pretty popular these days, which is exciting because it gives young people a new outlet for music that is tangible, and it's such a different experience to hold a record, put it on play, pick up the jacket, read the lyrics, or look at the artwork. It's such a different experience from clicking around online.
And how can people get the vinyl record if they want it?
It's available on my website, which is noosasounds.com.
Noosa spelled N-O-O-S-A.
N-O-O-S-A-S-O-U-N-D-S.com.
Very good. Now, I want to ask you the key question here is your music has been described a lot of different ways, but I think everybody describes it as unique. And your singing is unique, your composition is unique, and these are all complimentary comments that I've heard. But how would you describe your music? What genre does it fit into?
That's a tough one. Genre. I have coined it fairy pop because that's never been used before. It's somewhere between the worlds of indie, electronic, down-tempo. We can throw pop in there, although what does that really mean? I guess it's been pretty popular. Some folky influences as well.
Okay, and what has been your main inspiration as a creative artist and a composer?
My main inspiration has been listening to music. I've always been a music fan. So constantly listening to music, what do I like about this song or this artist and their voice and how they play. Also playing piano and guitar since I was younger and always inspiring myself with new sounds.
Okay. Well, are you going to be appearing in, you're living now in Los Angeles area. Are you going to be doing any personal appearances in the near future?
Personal appearances. There might be something coming up next month in LA, but I can't announce that officially because I don't know.
It's in July. Would it be on the Noosa website?
Yes. Any performances will be announced on the website or Facebook or Twitter. But right now I have nothing official planned. I'm writing new songs now and focusing on that.
And what is your Facebook page?
My Facebook page is facebook.com/Noosa Music. Unless it's Noosa Sounds. So try one of those. But everything is available on the website, all the links.
Well, thank you so much for this interview, and thank you so much for allowing us, helping to sponsor this podcast with your music and with your contributions. We appreciate it very much, and we look forward to playing more of your songs and wish you continued success as Noosa. Thank you, Sky.
Thank you. My pleasure. Nice talking to you. Good interview.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
Podcast number 8 with Dr. David Anderson. And we're going to talk, I was planning to talk in this segment about the paradigm of the human consciousness vis-a-vis the Montauk chair and how it relates to time and how it might parlay into the technology of Dr. David Anderson. But our host, who is Sean Bresnan, who's been quietly doing a good job for us recording this, you wanted to ask a question, Sean. Go ahead and ask your question of Dr. Anderson.
David, when someone's in the time reactor and you send them forwards and backwards in time, no matter how far back or forward it is, can you aim it, or is it only in the position in which the time reactor is?
I think he's asking if you can move him in space, not just time, correct?
Yes.
The answer to that is, the short answer is no, not at this time. Is it possible? Yes. Right now, you have to remember that it's not like a special relativistic effect. In relativity, you have, in physics, you have general and special. We're not accomplishing time distortion due to high rates of speed relative to others. We're actually creating fields of closed time like curves. So the actual moving forward, the acceleration or aggression of time occurs within the chamber itself. Now, there's a lot of complications around that would be pretty hard to answer without a lot of visual aids, but that's the short answer, Sean.
Along those lines, again, can you say how far forward or how far back someone or something has been sent in time?
Very far.
Oh, okay.
And we'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. That's all I have.
It's a good answer, and what I want to share with the audience is that what I had learned from studying David's material on his website and converting it into the article I wrote for the Montauk Pulse, my quarterly newsletter, is that it just became apparent to me that when the more you accelerate time, the further you're going to go back into time, and the more you decelerate time, the further you're going to go into the future. And David, you had confirmed that for me when I asked you the question. I mean, that's a very simplistic principle, but nevertheless, yes, it makes sense because that gives you some sort of benchmark on, the faster you accelerate, the further you go back. And so you could control where you're going by the rate of acceleration or the rate of deceleration. Am I correct?
You know, I have, yes, the answer is yes, you're correct. And actually, I have a new favorite. Your article that you just published on closed time like curves, I think, is one of the best I've ever written. And I have two things that anytime I meet with young people who are aspiring to get into space-time research, you know, we talk about the first thing you have to realize is you don't see the universe the way it is. You see the universe the way you are. And if you don't understand that, you'll never be successful. And when people see that light go on, they accomplish that. They do something remarkable. The second thing would be understanding the concept of closed time like curves. So I'm now putting you as number two in my list of three. And the third one is understanding that understanding how space-time works in our universe is algebra, not complicated calculus. And we have talked before about something called the invariance of the space-time interval. But if your podcast listeners are interested to understand in a simple mathematical way how simple space-time is to understand, study invariance of the space-time interval.
Well, yes, I put that in the earlier podcast. I explained it, and I told them how to draw dots, explain the mirror and all this sort of thing. And, of course, that's a very easy way to understand it. I've done articles on it also as well. They've appeared in various books of mine, and if somebody's really scratching their head over it, they're welcome to email me at skybooks@yahoo.com. And I will try to assist them. Now, also, one of the things on your website, and I didn't approach this in the article, but you said that there are time-like curves and there are space-like curves and there are light-like curves. I didn't go into the space-like or the light-like, but I was going to ask you, in reference to Sean's question, if approaching the problem he was discussing of moving people in space, could that perhaps be facilitated by addressing the concept of space-like curves?
It's an interesting question you ask, because I could take it a couple different ways, but the answer is there could be the way I'd reply is that, you know, we all probably understand from high school physics or college physics that special relativity and how, you know, an astronaut traveling to a distant star and back will age different than somebody who's sitting on the Earth who wasn't making the trip. But there is a possibility to mix the two technologies. And it's one of those things that we'd like to do sometime. We haven't been able to, and unfortunately that's a decades-long project, is the idea to put a time reactor on a long space mission moving at very high speeds and to study the effect to see if it can either cancel the the time dilation or greatly accelerate it.
Well, you know, I must ask you, when you speak of that, it reminds me back to our friends at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, in particular, the gentleman who you know, was helping us at Atlanticron, Ravi. I don't even know, is he familiar with your work at all, do you know? I mean, he knows who you are, but is he familiar with your work?
I think on the surface he's a little familiar. As you know, I don't, unless it's somebody in the academic area, I tend not to have a lot of conversations. So Ravi may or may not be. I do have a lot of colleagues at NASA who are very, very familiar with my work. And, of course, I've done projects with NASA in the past in related areas.
Well, it seems to be. Now, I can't answer for him, but they might sort of like, you know, look at this as, what wall is it coming off of? Because, I mean, well, I know some of your friends, you know, hadn't even known that you were involved in time research.
Well, there's a subtle thing. The big thing that we have, and this is the kind of for us what we think is going to be our kind of our holy grail with NASA, because I have tremendous respect for a lot of the work that NASA does. And but if you look at that that you referenced before, one of the videos, harvesting space-time motive force for clean energy,
right.
In there we talk about the ability of harvesting that force to for energy to for to harvest energy for space flight. And the idea with a time reactor is you do have an emitter collector. Sometimes they're sitting within a spherical environment in a laboratory to implement a discharge of energy from inertial frame dragging from a orbit in space. And what that would allow is any spaceship, theoretically, traveling to a distant location to stop at any body in space that's rotating, any planet, any moon, any large asteroid, and harvest energy from the inertial frame dragging created by that. So our hope is someday to see great funding to try to make that a reality. So we're basically any spitting body in space becomes your petrol station or your gas station.
Well, yes, and of course the time reactor could, I mean, we're not going to talk about going out to other stars, but a time reactor could make these flies around the solar system very fast and rapid.
Yeah, there's opportunities for that, and there's also the big opportunity is also for stasis fields. The ability to put, when we put somebody in a time reactor, you can greatly retard the time rate, almost stopping it, which would allow people to make those trips without great time passing on their part or the great physical needs and resources that come with
that. It's a more efficient way of what they used to use in spy movies of what they call suspended animation.
Yes. Yes, the nice thing about that, it doesn't come with all the, it's clean, pure, and simple, without the need for cryogenics of any type and all the potential risks and damage that can come from that.
Of course, and we had in those two famous movies, Planet of the Apes in 2001, where some of the astronauts didn't survive because of the, you know, in one case the suspended animation was sabotaged by the computer, in the other case, I guess it just malfunctioned. So
that'll be the first product, by the way, Peter, that everybody sees when the governments start relinquishing the technology. The applications are already, the products are already there, or the prototypes are there, I should say. But stasis fields, that stasis field from science fiction, from Star Trek, or whatever your favorite sci-fi movie or episode is, are reality. And the applications for that, it doesn't take much to think about what happens if somebody has a serious injury to get them into a stasis field to give you all the time in the world to prepare to handle it in the most efficient and expeditious manner is amazing. It's actually mind-boggling when you really get to the details of it.
All right. Now, I'm going to get back to what I wanted to talk about in this segment, which was the human interface. And, of course, in Montauk, we had the psychic and the personage of Duncan Cameron, who was actually, he was a big component of the literal manipulation of time. And, you know, I can't spit out, if I had Preston here, he could spit it out real fast about, you know, all the weird things that were going on or the complicated things that going on. And he was being, his mind was being hooked up to radio receivers that were being amplified, and his thoughts were literally getting into the, you talk about creating reality. You talk about an interface of reality and bridging it into time. I don't, and I guess all I can ask you about this, because you're really not doing it, but I'm saying is you don't dismiss it as a way. There's certainly a human interface there that ran into a lot of trouble because there was a lot of manipulation in what going on, a lot of esoteric energy. See, that was a big project. The Montauk Project was this, the project operators attempting to control time, and they were monkeying with time, and they got, when I talked about you finding a bigger fish, well, they found a bigger fish if it was just the event itself, and it overwhelmed everybody. It overwhelmed everybody, and so you have this disaster. And this is part urban legend, and it's part truth. But we have this big disaster, and then you have the afterwash of it, and you have Preston Nichols trying to figure it out, and then I come along and hear the story and write it down, and that's eventually how we make contact. It's a result of a failed time experiment, and I'm sitting there picking up the pieces, and you read the book and, you know, eventually make contact with us. Let me just ask you, let me switch the question and ask you, how did you first learn of the Montauk Project, and what happened when you read the book?
Boy, that's a good question. I can't remember what place and time I ran across the Montauk Project.
Probably
I read it with quite earnest.
When did you move to Long Island?
Oh my goodness, you're really going to put me to the test there.
90s.
Yeah, but I can't remember, Peter, when I read it, but what I was really fascinated by it was the fact that, and it's something I didn't appreciate at the time, and I think it'll come full circle. I think the greatest achievement in our area will be, I'm going to revisit two points I made. The greatest achievement in space-time research is going to occur when consciousness is integrated into the control system of a time reactor, for example. And the other thing is, you know, we talk about this, about a lot of people think reality creates consciousness. The reality, the physical world, our material makeup creates the consciousness, when in fact, you know, maybe it's the consciousness that creates the reality. And I'm not saying anything that people haven't explored for thousands of years, but you know, the idea of integrated consciousness and consciousness being an indispensable part of this is key. And again, I go back to that statement. You know, we don't see the universe the way it is. We see it the way we are, and we do not see reality. What is reality? We see amazing things happen in a time warp field. There's amazing things that happen in the world around us every day that we can't see, but they are part of our real universe. We just don't see it. And so how do we know that, you know, the consciousness, even in our experiments, is not a part of that?
Well, let me ask you then, people are going to listen to this and they're going to say, well, how can they participate in something like, you know, everybody would obviously like to see the time reactor, but what you're alluding to, and that's not really pragmatic at this point, but people will want to, you know, how can they part in the future? How can they expect to participate in the benefits of this technology in terms of including their consciousness with the evolution of this technology?
That's the issue where disclosure is key. And, you know, it really doesn't matter. Even some of the great things that governments have tried to eventually over some period or distance, the disclosure will win. And that's the only answer I have for you, Peter, and your listeners, is disclosure is key. This needs to be disclosed. It needs to be discussed. People need to understand what's happening. There needs to be oversight of how the technology is used, even in the research lab. That's probably all I can offer.
But how might it evolve an individual? Say the typical person might come home and watch TV, whatever entertains him, and TV can, you know, tend to zap your energy, and it's not always a very productive thing to do. But this is what people do. Is there some sort of, I guess, parallel, you might say, with this technology where they might come home and, you know,
I tell you,
Google time.
I tell you, the biggest thing to affect that change, and I am a campaigner for it, I am totally in support of it, is to offer public demonstrations of time reactors. And you know behind this, Peter, and I'll just repeat it for your listeners. One of the most amazing things is to watch somebody's first presentation seeing an operating time reactor and see some of the experiments we do to demonstrate. The typical reaction is emotion, crying, laughter. But one of the biggest things that happens in my environment, for everybody who's seen a time reactor, I'll usually get a call back a few weeks afterwards or a few months afterwards, and they'll tell me one thing: I cannot go on with my life, and I can never look at the world the same way again because of what I saw there. And that type of power, powerful effect in leading people, and not to be so spiritual here, but leading people to enlightenment. When they see that, all of a sudden they begin to realize there is so much more to our universe that they don't understand. It's such a powerful thing that it can affect change. And that would be the first thing. Time reactors, the time research in China, in quantum tunneling, the work in India, all those prototypes need to be taken out of the lab and put on public display and demonstrated with videos shared. And that would do what you said.
I finally understand something now that I've always never really understood, was your public relations effort. I mean, I understand that it's nice to know this stuff, and of course, it goes hand in hand with what I write about, so it's a natural fit for me. But in terms of educating people, sort of brings a aha moment or 100th monkey effect with the population to where this stuff is natural. It's, you know, and people like me can become a footnote in the history of telling these stories or whatnot, a footnote, and because everybody knows it, and it's transferred through. It's getting the awareness of people to see that reality is not what they thought.
Exactly.
It was.
But you know what? We do shrink it. Peter, you know it. We shrink all the magic in the world and everything we can and can't see to the size of our material possessions and daily routine. This is why hitting somebody in the face with an actual, you know, live demonstration is what is key. And it needs to happen everywhere, not just with time reactors, with some of the work that's being done in Japan for superluminal propagation. The work in China is amazing, and I wish people could see that. It's absolutely stupendous. It's a little harder to visualize than a time reactor, but it's equally amazing.
Well, you had a video done by the Discovery Channel. I think it was the center in Long Island, or was it in New Mexico?
Yeah, there was actually who was it? Who was it that came out? Yeah, there was a video that was done. A whole crew came out. We did a whole series of shoots, and this was a guy who was an employee for the Discovery Channel, and they did all the shoots, everything, and it just kind of faded out. And then I think there was a gentleman, Barry Chavron, who came back and tried to redo it, and then the group, somehow it faded away again. But the whole video was shot, and someday that's going to show up. I know it is.
Well, did it show the time reactor in action?
It showed elements of it. It didn't show the big amazing efforts, but it did show some really, really impressive, eye-opening things. Even that, by today's standards, would be amazing for public disclosure.
Did it show as much as we saw at Montauk with the Amaryllis plant growing faster than it would? Did the documentary show that? Is that much or less or more?
It was more. We showed both the good side and the bad side of a time reactor at that time, which we were struggling with. That was when we had the boundary layer problems and the stability issues.
And of course, so when this goes into the media, they're very, what is it? It's called, there's a group called, something in media that basically authorizes what goes on the air, what's suitable, censorships, everything in media. It's a very controlled group, and obviously they tie into the political framework of what we've been talking. I mean, they might not be in the same circle of censorship that the political environment that you have had to deal with, but this is its own separate deal of censorship, which, as I say, could turn the corner. It could turn the corner or turn the vector, reverse the vector of this issue. So this becomes important, and I want to acknowledge at this point in the podcast all of the previous people who have had you on for interviews, whether it be on YouTube, the radio, or whatever it is, from including Freeman Fly and Hillary Ramo come to mind, Art Bell, and I think Whitley Strieber. I don't know if he had you on, but he contributed to the Art Bell interview connection. But anyway, all of these people who have tried to put this issue forward, I want to acknowledge them, and the many people I haven't mentioned that had you on previously, because everything that they've done is helping to bring this technology and this idea. And of course, as from my own viewpoint, with the Montauk Project, which is how I initially became known as a writer and whatnot, is that all I knew was that something happened. We didn't know what happened. And something of a highly irregular nature out there happened. And Preston coming out with these theories of time, he literally, with his theories being exposed, changed the way the world looked at time, the way the science community looked at time. He contributed to that greatly, even though he was highly discounted and discredited at every chance. His genius was... certainly came through in many respects. But I've always enjoyed everything you've brought to the table because it validates so many of the hard science aspect of what may or may not have occurred.
And I would encourage, I'd encourage your listeners to explore that. You know, one of the steps towards disclosure is everybody, and whether it be the work we're doing, if people want to understand more about the nature of time in our universe and how we fit in it and how it interacts with our mind and our consciousness and our physical world, study it. Study time from a historical concept, from a science fiction concept, from a physics concept, from a philosophy, from an art perspective, and study it over the last couple thousand years for every piece of information you can find. And you... is what you learn. There's a lot of good information. The only thing I can hope, Peter, is we want to publish a lecture series. It'll probably be about a 6 or 8 video lecture series where we want to release a lot of information that I think the world will find very new, very refreshing, and very eye-opening. That's our hope.
You wanted to
do this. We've been working on it now for almost 17 months.
And this literally could... change, well, at least influence the world. It could change it, create dynamic change.
Yep. That's what we're trying to do, yes. And a solution to disclosure is going to come from a grassroots perspective. It doesn't matter what it is. When the government didn't want to, let's pick the United States just because you're sitting there now. When the government didn't want something to have, whether it be women to vote or gay rights or whatever the subject would be, it's always the grassroots movements that overcome that. And that's something that we're going to try to fuel because we believe in it. We believe everybody should be aware of the opportunities and risks in the technology.
The one thing I would say about disclosure is two things. The first thing is when you expect a government to disclose things, and not just a government, but any could be applied to a corporate executive, or you see this in legal cases, people are only going to disclose what they have to disclose. They don't want to disclose everything. So you expect them to give you, here, you can look at this, like say the government will give you a freedom of information request and, the whole page might be blacked out. This sort of thing. You expect disclosure that's not real disclosure. So you don't necessarily, you get it in bits and pieces.
I will tell your listeners, they're not going to get it on the on the mini documentaries on the TV. Go look for it yourself and look at it through history. You know, a lot of the things that we're talking about are not necessarily new concepts, new principles. Why the technology and the tools around the capabilities are newer. A lot of the repercussions and what it means for human society has been considered for a long time.
The second thing I want to say about disclosures, you have this disclosure concept or movement in the UFO movement, and it's really, to me, it's always been ludicrous because you have all these people talking about disclosure, and it's such a joke because it's like they're all being strung along like a red herring, and it's like disclosure is going to happen, and it turns into a big drama. And of course, there's never any, and I just say there's never going to be any disclosure on that subject. This is a little bit different because it's not so, you know, it's science fiction like, but it's not, we're not dealing with that sort of weird element. But now I have a question before we go to the next subject. Is Anne asks about deja vu. She says, do you think we experience deja vu? It's because we've been taken back and replaced back a few moments before the time we were taken. What do you think about deja vu?
Well, obviously I'm not. I have a lot of, almost spiritual beliefs about that. But, maybe it's ties into alternate reality. It may be moving time back. You know, if I would answer this way for Anna. If you ask a Buddhist monk that question, they would, you know, and you talked about science and technology versus the power of the mind, they would laugh at the notion that the human mind can't transcend time. So the idea that the human mind could transcend time either by moving forward or back or viewing perhaps an alternate reality in the depths of the consciousness that we don't understand, it's very, very possible. But it's not my area of expertise, Peter, so I have to back off that one, and my apologies.
Well, it's a pretty good answer, actually. It's certainly a consciousness of we have been here before.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what deja vu is. You think I've been here before.
Yeah.
This has happened again. And I think it's been explained as a sort of a irregularity in the cognitive process.
See, that's where the scientific method breaks down. You know, years ago, you know, how many hundreds or thousands of years ago, you know, the scientific method and the church and spiritual beliefs separated. And what you see now, it really is a reconvergence, which is a good thing. You know, of course, scientific method, we have to be able to observe, measure, and predict. Well, what happens when your senses are only able to see and perceive and measure and predict, you know, 1% of the true universe around you? Where does insight play? And that's the interesting thing. You know, for me, a lot of people make a big to-do about the super colliders and particle accelerators. For me, the only magic about that, it's proving that the world really is a dynamic web of energy and everything is interconnected, whether we see it, perceive it, or not. And they're proving that the beliefs held by, you know, Buddhists and Taoists thousands of years ago are now true using the scientific method. That's nice because the scientific method was there to validate what people believed 2,000 years ago, but it took 2,000 years. And the scientific method has become limiting, very, very limiting. It should be one element of research, and that's something at the Institute we try to break down the barriers. And the reason I say that, I'm not promoting the Anderson Institute. We don't have anything to sell. What I'm really saying is for your listeners, keep an open mind. Use your insight. Read, study, and then meditate on this if that's what you do. But there's a lot of ways to look at. If you want to understand the true nature of time, you're not going to get it through one discipline in academic study. Study them all.
Okay. This is very interesting. I hope you can keep going a bit because I've got some more things I want to cover.
Sure.
And end off this segment. Maybe you want to get a drink of water.
I'm good.
Let's end this segment, and we'll continue with another one.
Okay.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Noosa.
So this is part five of podcast number eight with Dr. David Anderson. And what I want to talk about here is I want to go on some of the subjects that have been covered in the books on Romania by Radu Shinamar. And he says some very fascinating and interesting things. Of course, he talks about a chamber beneath the Romanian Sphinx that has a archive of the history of the world that he says cuts off in about 400 or 500 AD. He claims to have actually witnessed this, and he describes it in his books, what he actually saw in time. So he's witnessing time. What's of perhaps more interesting than that particular adventure is he goes in the third book, Mystery of Egypt. There's three tunnels in this chamber. One goes to Tibet via Baghdad with an offshoot to Baghdad and another offshoot to Mongolia. The other tunnel goes into the inner earth, and another tunnel goes to beneath the Giza Plateau. And the one that goes to the Giza Plateau is like a almost like a parallel reality, because the tunnel doesn't go very far, but there's this device which is, maybe it looks like a time reactor array. Maybe you would recognize it as that. And it kind of puts you into another bubble reality, and he's going through virtual tunnels that look just like tunnels. And along the way, I guess there's station points, but he eventually ends up in this chamber beneath Egypt's Giza Plateau. Some of my friends in Egypt say this is geographically described is very plausible. But what's there is a time travel device. It's described with a lot of crystals, like a crystal bed. It's very crystalline. And it's not a technology that we would understand from our 21st century, but whatever, it provides time travel with the mind. It is also bioresonant. It is not a device or claim to be the one you can actually travel into time with, only with the mind, and it's bioresonant. So you're gonna go to where you might want to go, or where I might go. I would go where I might want to go. And I also wonder, because it's bioresonant, how much is it literally that person's mind or consciousness creating the circumstance? But when you talk about it's potentially dangerous to look into time, even to look into it, I never heard you say that before. Certainly to travel or to manipulate circumstances, yes. But even the act of looking into it can have a profound effect. When I describe a technology like this that's in the book Mystery of Egypt, what might you say about that?
Well, the first, and again, this is a theory on our part, if you look at the exotic materials that are found in, and I'll probably pronounce it wrong, but Cioclovina Cave in the southern Carpathians, basically all the exotic materials appear in crystallized form. And sticking to what I know instead of speculating, that's one fact I could tell you, whether it be the hydroxy ledastate, lignite, or some of the other materials there. So there are crystals. We do have a theory that was a discharge of space-time motive force from the atmosphere to the Earth, just a theory. There's some theories that say it was a bat guano fire, but we don't buy that. We don't see the circumstances in that being something that could have created this, and it is very unusual. So that'd be one thing that would be a part of your story. Or the comments that you made. And I don't know if I caught the second one or not.
Well, it's basically the idea of looking into these people. Well, actually, they go into time, or they can look into this device. It's look into it. It's kind of like being in a chair of sorts. And they can actually travel consciously in time. In that particular story, he goes back to the time of Christ and sees Christ and has some adventures and this sort of thing. And no, understanding the Romanian culture the way I do, I could see why a Romanian might identify with Christ, because they're very, I guess, inundated with that religion, the majority of the people. So they identify with it very strongly and emotionally in ways that the Americans don't quite deal with it the same way. But in any case, it's very bioresonant in this guy's soul, who is a very psychic individual in the book. And in any case, it's just the idea of a device whereby you actually go back in time mentally. That's, I'm sort of asking you about that.
There is nothing that we see within the laws of physics. I know it's more of a theory, but I do believe passionately, and it's more of a belief, not a scientific proof, that the power of the human mind and consciousness can't create that ability. If you look at it, you look at things like, you know, China. Like I said, before they went dark, they broke, I think it was 4, maybe 5 world records for demonstrating that quantum tunneling actually allows at low energy to pass information faster than the speed of light. And they set 5 world records on that, or 4. So the human mind, when you look at the way the human mind works, just what we understand, the little bit we understand of it, you know, why would it preclude it? And I've always been a believer, whether I'm not an expert or not, and others, that the ability to transcend time again can be achieved multiple ways.
Well, yes, but see, what was curious about this to me is that this technology was from, ostensibly from a civilization that's very old and far
yes.
more advanced and but they're not. This actually isn't for traveling. It's like it's only for mentally going to places. The other okay. aspect of this station, and this is beneath the Giza Plateau as described in the book, is a source of archives of time that appear roughly like a slate that might be likened to a CD, but it's a slate, and then it would read out a holographic projection. These are time archives, literal time archives that are reading out in holographic form. And the part of their mission was to take a lot of these archived CDs, if you will, and bring them back to the United States for evaluation, bring them back to the Pentagon, because one of the characters on the mission is a genius who's sort of wired into his own computer, and he has a laptop that reads out holographically. They explain a computer in the Pentagon that is a bigger computer, that is a holographic computer. It's an incredible story. It's an incredible extrapolation. If it's not true, it's an incredible extrapolation of what could occur in the future, so that the technology is, like, really amped up. And they're talking about these time archives, and it's all – see, this is taking it from the exploration of time to what's happened. Now, I'm not really asking you a question here. I'm kind of taking this opportunity to tell you a little bit about these stories of time. But when I heard this story, I began to scratch my head and say, well, who are these jolly people that are going to be sitting in the Pentagon? Are they going to bring people over from the CIA and the FBI to watch these huge amounts of things to evaluate these time archives? I mean, it would take forever to have a whole team of people to watch these, and what are they going to do? Take notes. When I thought about it a little further, I heard of this huge, and I don't remember the exact location in Utah, I think it's in the Salt Lake City, the mountain area, where they have these huge computer capacity. It's gigantic. It's way beyond gigabytes and what are the, trilobytes, what do they call it, the T-bytes?
Terabytes.
It's beyond terabytes. So it's like, then I realized, I said, well, if you're going to take this technology to the United States, you're not going to have these people in the CIA and FBI or wherever you dig them up to watch these things and take notes. You're going to put it into you're going to download it into a computer that has such a huge capacity, and then you have things archived in time in a computer that so you can pull them up. I mean, this is sort of like the Google Time concept I was talking about. And it was just the description. In the book, they describe some of the technology they have for the device they're driving. It's really impressive in terms of the technology they described. If he wrote this book and had access to this, if he didn't, he certainly had some insights into technology. And this was all American technology used by the Romanians. The only thing I could ask you, I mean, you're welcome to comment on it, but my only thing to ask you, and you sort of answered the question, is this idea of recording time. I don't know if this is something that you get into.
Well, that's a dangerous area. There's a lot of debate in the scientific community. Let's just use the technology for observation. The problem is, like I mentioned before, something that this is why we're an adamant opposer of it is our brothers and sisters. You know, the observer effect is very, very prevalent. The idea of recording, you know, there's no reason why, and it's probably being done now. The recording and the viewing through different places in time. The problem is there is a very, very pronounced and easy to prove observer effect by viewing. Just the process of viewing all alone can change. And not trying to get hung up on what people sometimes call the Heisenberg uncertainty. It's really an observer effect. We've seen it clearly, is that there is a ripple effect, and every time an experiment is run, whether it be us with the time reactor, China with their quantum tunneling experiments, Japan with their superluminal propagation, every time they do that, it has an effect and literally will change that historical record or could potentially change it. So doing that without understanding the consequences is a very risky thing, but most likely it's going to be more reality than it is fiction, Peter.
Well, yes, and the whole idea – well, see, this is the thing. If we go back and read history, we can go to the library and read history. A lot of that is not accurate. And it's not – I mean, not because it's lied about. It's just not accurate because it doesn't cover – you can read The History of the World by Will Durant, and you can find out that – well, it's a very rough outline, and a lot of it is out of context and not exactly true and omits a lot of information. So, in other words, we don't really – when we go back and read history – we're already living in a ripple effect.
See, that's where you got to take it a step further. This is why I always bring up brothers and sisters. Think about it. You know, again, you're in front of an experiment. You put the genetic, the DNA makeup of plant seedlings, parent plant seedlings, into a regression, bring them back, and all of a sudden the genetic makeup of something outside the test has changed. How do I know my reality hasn't changed and my consciousness hasn't been affected? If that can happen with another organism, maybe more directly linked with what was put inside the chamber and inside the reactor and regressed, how do I know that didn't have a ripple effect on me? Would I ever know? Or would I just phase out of existence and that never happened?
Let me ask you now, I know that you haven't found out about parallel universes. You haven't encountered this in your research. But in studying one of the definitions of, I forget what it was, but the multiverse – and I know that you accept the concept of a multiverse, but a parallel universe is a corollary or a component of the multiverse. Could you explain multiverse and parallel universe and the relationship between the two? And this from a physics standpoint.
Oh my goodness! See, I'm very one-sided on it. You know, a lot of people, you know, they talk about a multiverse being, it's more of the idea that there are a finite or infinite number of universes existing all at the same time. Well, I believe in the idea of people perceiving things across another boundary of their universe. I don't believe necessarily in the parallel universe construct. And I say that from observation. Like I say, in brothers and sisters, you know, there's that theory in time travel that says if you make a change or you go back in time and make a change, two branches branch off. That's not what we saw. What we saw is when we put seedlings from the same genetic family into a regressed time reactor field, is that the genetic makeup changed in that reality. They went in with the reference group with the same DNA structure, and when it came out, the DNA structure of what was in the Gress chamber, along with the record of that DNA code, didn't match.
Did you ever have occasion to have a camera accompanying it so you could actually watch what the camera was recording as it changed the DNA, or a microscope or something like that?
Not at that level of detail, no. Yeah, video is part of it, but not at that level of detail.
Experiment, would it not?
Yeah, it depends, but you have to also understand that when you're experiencing an accelerated or decelerated time rate, and you're in that reference frame, it doesn't matter whether you're in a time reactor or whether in a spaceship flying at, 90% of the speed of light across the universe, your senses as if you were sitting still. You're not going to perceive anything different.
Well, but we're talking about a camera on a plant. We're not a perceiver. So the camera is looking at the plant and it's not going to see any difference in the plant.
Exactly. You could say, some people would say, and from my mind, that was an important experiment for a lot of reasons, because it pointed out the hazard. But also pointed out in my mind is that it makes me less believing in the concept of parallel simultaneous universe.
Well, yes, but my interesting thing is you put a camera on a plant inside of a self-contained field, and it's looking at in the DNA, say, we'll just call it ABC. And by the time it comes out, it's DEF. And at some point, it changed.
Yeah. But what changed in our experiment wasn't what was in the time reactor. What changed in our experiment was part of the same family of seedlings that was in the lab. That's the mind blower.
Okay, so could you have a camera or microscope on those in the lab? That would be the next level of experiment to see what's going. And
if you let me one of your real time DNA makeup recorders, we'll put one in each and we'll. It's something that's discussed, but it actually gets very complicated, because your reality is your reality wherever you are. How do you when you have two separate reference frames? The reality is unique in each.
But what I'm saying is, is it that hard technologically to get a microscope to actually focus it on the DNA of the brother sister plant in real time?
Not a microscope, but there's no such thing as a real time DNA reader today, so, or DNA viewer. Not at that level.
For example, I
can answer your question a different way, because we're tripping on we're running. This is where the rational mind bumps into its own limitations. Your beautiful wife heads off on a trip to a distant star. 90% of the speed of light comes back, and it turns out you faded out of existence about 500 years before, and she only aged 10 years. Now, if you were recording a camera inside your reference frame, you would have aged on Earth with no unusual consequences, and your lovely wife, who was in a spaceship, would have aged that exact amount. There would be no observable effect, but the time differences would have been that pronounced.
And you're both in two different realities.
You're both. Essentially, you could say you're in two different realities, yes, if you wanted to.
Yes. But as I say, you can get a microscope and look at a plant and look at its DNA, correct? Am I not?
You can use chemical processes to determine and record DNA.
But that you can't. The microscope is not good enough to actually read it.
Not to read it and record it and compare it.
Well, it's an interesting. Maybe somebody will have to invent something like that.
I didn't jump on the multiverse comment. You know, the universe means all of everything. So a multiverse is multiple copies of all of everything. So a multiverse is sometimes a word that kind of strikes me a little funny. But the point is, what's one of the great things that's coming out of the research when I said those words at the start of the interview, we're actually changing the real definition of not only what it means to be human, but the definition of reality itself.
Well, that is very fascinating, and that has a lot of implications there. I also want to ask you about your old, I don't know if you call him a colleague or friend, John Archibald Wheeler, the famous physicist.
Oh, yeah, yep, of course, a colleague, yep. It was terrible when he passed away several years ago, but he was himself and Edwin Taylor, for your podcast listeners, Space-Time Physics, buy their book. It is the best and the only book I ever recommend for people to read, but it is a more of a college-level textbook, as long as that doesn't turn anybody off.
Well, he was he was part of the Everett Wheeler hypothesis of the many worlds theory, which you're obviously familiar with.
A little.
Just a little, because that was that was the whole sort of underpinning of the Ong's hat phenomena or stuff associated with that book, because it was just, you know, the whole idea of parallel worlds. What I will say, when I was first introduced to this concept in about 1994, this was a very dirty word in physics. In fact, the Everett Wheeler hypothesis, people that were like dyed-in-the-wool physicists would react very harshly at this idea. I mean, it was the emotional reaction was too strong. And so this alone was enough to make one, you know, give it some degree of validity just by the harsh, visceral, emotional reaction certain people would have in the physics community. This was pointed out to me, and then I actually witnessed it just by asking a question about it, not asserting anything about it. And so that was, it's always interesting when you see the emotion of people. And of course, you know, you don't react to it emotionally. You just haven't encountered it, and you have reason to, you know, you deal with the subject. So, you know, you obviously know what you're talking about.
But my observations, like I say, I can only base it on my observations. My observations in the lab have significantly changed my perspective in life. And that the idea of the many worlds interpretation is that they all exist parallel, all possible, you know, alternative histories exist at the same time. We don't see anything. If anything, we see more leading evidence that that's not the case, and that the effect of exposing one part of our universe to accelerated or decelerated time rates actually will change the construct of the existing universe, even beyond the experiment, and not have an alternative timeline effect. And it's one of the areas, actually, we are spending a lot of time on. These are questions that in my mind are some of the most important things that we're doing to try to answer, but it can be very difficult to construct experiments to, you know, finitely prove it. So we just continue to gather data, come up with new experiments to understand what, you know, the best of what we can observe.
Thank you very much. I've also been asked to ask you about the relationship between time travel or time control technology and particle accelerators and or nuclear energy.
Well, particle accelerators, I don't see. I see the opportunity to learn about the construct of our universe. I definitely see that. With regards to time travel, for anybody who asked that question, I only have one response. Take a look at the total energy that's created in a collision in a particle accelerator. It's probably about the energy level of a small hummingbird. You know, so the amount of the one thing that's accepted today, at least in the classical scientific method in physics, is that to achieve curvature in space-time, it takes a tremendous amount of energy, whether you put that into your experiment or whether you're harvesting it naturally occurring. So particle accelerators, I don't see any correlation at all. The only place that it really helps is for those people who are working in quantum tunneling. Understanding how things happen on a quantum level. Quantum tunneling, again, is a way that organizations have been since the 1970s, and now really developing, sending information faster than the speed of light. And the second half of that, outside of particle accelerators, Peter, I lost.
Well, nuclear energy, nuclear power.
I don't have any comment or to share on that other than there are better alternatives.
It's not really a part of the time control technology, is what you're saying.
No, not at all. Not at all. There's no physical, chemical a link between them. My only passion with regards to energy is the idea of harvesting naturally occurring space-time motive force, either to benefit human society on the Earth as a clean energy alternative, or to re-energize ships on deep space missions.
And I should also comment that you are highly qualified to talk on particle accelerators and nuclear energy, are you not?
I know quite a bit, yes, and I do follow most of what's going on in the world.
All right. Now, there was another aspect I wanted to, and this is with regards to the Romania scenario as involved in the books that I published. And it's back to what I was saying about the time travel device, where it was a mental time travel device. And he starts asking questions to go back to who's controlling the technology. He wants to see what is the race that put together this technology. And then he's got censorship on the technology itself. Like whoever created the technology put in built-in censorship so he couldn't find out who did it, which I found was a very interesting concept. In other words, it was a control censorship factor. And if we take these stories at face value, it's a pretty highly evolved technology, and the people accessing it have some pretty highly access to phenomena going on between the secret levels of the Romanian and the American government. But the censorship is built into the technology itself, because you're not dealing with an alien technology. It doesn't really, affect.
We're just dealing with technology that's alien to most people walking through their daily lives.
Yes, but you're creating the technology. You're building the technology. You're not depending
yes.
upon. You're not reverse engineering. You're not dealing with something that has been landed on your lap or taken to Area 51 to study or all this sort of things.
You know what's interesting, though? We're creating the technology. Yeah, I like to say more. We're just simply harvesting some of the naturally occurring energy that we take for granted and don't use and don't want to see. And we're harnessing it in a way that just so happens to create these closed fields of closed time like curves. We've learned how to control them. We can do wonderful things. We've learned how to better visualize the true nature of time, which really advances our work. And that's important. I was going to drift on a tangent, but that
go
was
ahead,
my response.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, visualizing, when you're working on the bleeding edge of a technology that is doing what it's doing now, and I see this all over. The greatest physicists working on here, they do visualize now what the nature and relationship between time and space is, and that's what you brought up, John Archibald Wheeler and his colleague Edwin Taylor, who wrote the book Space Time Physics. There's another enlightenment that happens short of seeing a time warp field in action in a time reactor. It's when a student realizes, hey, we don't see the universe the way it is. We see the universe the way we are. That's number one. And when they understand what John Archibald Wheeler was writing in that book, the light goes on and they just start running a race and they just become consumed with moving forward, our understanding and our understanding of space-time and our place in it. And that's how powerful that book is. It's a tiny little formula, little Pythagorean formula that, for your listeners, let me put it in perspective. If you were trying to solve prior to their work, if you were trying to solve a complicated problem in space-time physics, you might need some of the world's best computers in weeks. And after their book, it basically would allow a high school student to solve most of those problems with simple algebra in 3 to 5 minutes. And not the important thing about the time solving the problem is that because of what they taught in there, it allowed people, because it was so simple mathematically, it took a construct of our universe we don't perceive, and it may put it into a simple algebraic equation, and it basically allowed them to visualize the nature of space and time and how they're related to each other across different perspectives. And that allowed visualization. Once you can visualize and see and feel that, and honestly it might be 1 out of 50, 1 out of 100 people can do it, then the possibilities become almost limitless. And that was all because of their book.
Wow. That's, well, yeah.
And we build on that a lot. I mean, a lot of our work has been within the reactor, a huge, huge component. As a matter of fact, the reactor wouldn't exist if it wouldn't been for the work they did and where we've taken it with the space-time interval algorithms.
Well, this leads into another question I was going to ask you. And in the tradition of alchemy, and alchemy is a very deep tradition, which is not very well understood, and it's featured a very cogent, incredible description is featured in the book Transylvanian Moonrise with this alchemist who's given the name Eleanor. He really does exist. And he's part of a tradition where one bite can evolve into literally living not only beyond one's years, but evolving out of the human state. And it's a long tradition. It takes hundreds of years to accomplish. But one of the traditions of alchemy, not necessarily mentioned in that book, is that when an alchemist, now keep in mind the purpose of alchemy is to transmute base metals into gold, which is a metaphor for transmuting lower into the higher, taking us to a higher plane of existence. And part of this tradition is when the alchemist is very sincere and he's really knows his stuff, and you are an example of somebody who's worked very steadfastly, doggedly for decades on a very driven course, which is arguably more interesting than alchemy. But it says that out of nowhere will appear this character, and they refer to him as Elias or Elias Artista. And he is like a sort of like appears ephemerally, and he'll give them some magic information, and he'll kind of disappear. You know, what happened? What happened? The student who has done his good job. This sort of thing will happen as I study Qigong. You'll kind of get visited and boom, boom. And then you'll tell the teacher, oh, yeah, yeah. But in my life, and I've had many incredible characters, you've been somebody who sort of appeared like this and sort of like given me information or, you know, you appear here and there. But I must ask you, has anything like that parallel happened to you where you're given a inspiration from somebody or something and says, you know, and you kind of like, God, what just happened? It might be something you're not even wanting to talk about, but has anything like that ever happened to you?
The answer is yes, and you're right. You know me very well, Peter. It's not something I tend to discuss too often, but, I do question sometimes the path we're on and, are there opportunity or instances that are already occurring to help guide us in what we're trying to do? It is a possibility, but again, so far outside of my comfort zone and experience zone to speak about that I don't have much to say.
It's a very good answer to know that your inspiration has been a little more than just somebody who figured out some really neat things in from having a unique position to study with the Air Force and to study. You know, obviously your own mind is pretty advanced in regards to the sciences. But, yes, your own personal journey or studying, if you would ever write about it, would be utterly fascinating in terms of I figured that out, and how it – I know you're not big on promoting yourself, and it's not – but it would be interesting. It would be very interesting – for other people to read. But I know it also is going to mix in with security issues and whatnot. But back to what I was talking about, this alchemist, I do know he exists in the book because he spoke to the publisher, my publisher, who you've met, Sorin Hormuz, in Bucharest. And he's described, well, I found out, when I went to the house of this well-to-do man in Bucharest. I went to his house in 2012 along with Jeanette Crowley. She was invited, and I got to come along. And he was the friend of a very important politician who I later met that night. And when I was in his neighborhood, I immediately recognized it as Eleanor's neighborhood. It was unmistakable. It's a very new area of Bucharest with these beautiful homes, and the home was just could have been like was described in the book. But I found out, this is interesting, and I don't know this for sure, but I have reason to believe that Eleanor's house, which I do not know specifically, is adjacent to the Chinese embassy. And on the other side is the Chinese mafia, so-called. Mm-hmm. And because there's always a relationship between China and Romania, as you well know, from the communist days. And there is a very mysterious character in the book who's described as Rinpoche Sundi. He's a Tibetan Lama who found his way as a doctor of the paranormal in Red China, when it was Red China, and he set up the paranormal Department Zero in Romania back in the, I think it was the 70s. So this connection with the Chinese, I just kind of mention it because it also parlays into my experiences in San Francisco's Chinatown with the Ong's Hat book, which is a whole nother, the secret societies. Let's just say that China, Sun Yat-sen, who was the president of China, actually ran the government, the exile government, from this little red building in San Francisco that I had occasion to visit. They wouldn't let me in. They said that I had to talk to the FBI first. The FBI, they had it locked up. That's a whole other story. But I just mentioned this is only as a sort of an intrigue of the China as it all interrelates to all of this stuff in Romania. I don't know if you have any comment on that. It really wasn't a question. It was more of a comment of my own.
For me, the thing out of all that, I can't add a whole lot. For me, though, there seemed to be, and I'm not very qualified to use the word synchronicity, but there seemed to be a lot of paths that seemed to cross in Romania. And a lot of paths seemed to lead there, and a lot of new information, and a lot thanks to you, too, really going out and researching areas of the country and some very interesting regions and sharing that with the world. I'm not qualified to comment on those and how they tie to what we see and what brought us there, but that's the only thing I can tell you about all that.
Well, I had questions of maybe I should have said that, maybe I shouldn't, but the next thing you know, I'll probably be getting an email or two about the Chinese embassy in Bucharest. But which I do hope to visit. I mean, someday, go knock on the door. I may be well received. I may not. I was very warmly received in Chinatown, much to my surprise. It's a much more open society than it was when I grew up in California. But back to the books of Radu, the gold deposits beneath Sarmizegetuza, which is the holy place of the ancient Dacians of what the land we now call Transylvania, huge tunnels of gold that go on for miles, according to the book. And the geologists, of course, know there's huge gold deposits there, gigantic gold deposits. Whether it's pure gold is another question. I also believe we know there's a mother lode that's not been tapped in California, and the Chinese were all over that whole thing. That's a whole nother podcast I'll do at a future point. But just the California gold, the Chinese connection to that, and because you mentioned China as an issue, but the gold, I have to ask you, is there any gold is, of course, a goal of alchemy, and it's superconductive. This is a question I had to ask you, and I'm putting two questions in here. I was going to ask you about gold, but you also mentioned on another podcast about superconductivity, and gold is a superconductor. And of course, gold being beneath these mountains in Transylvania that must be very close to Chocolabina Cave, if not leading right up to it. Any comment on gold as a superconductor with time control technology?
Well, the only thing I can say about the observations there in Romania, in that area, the Carpathians, would be again, when there's a discharge, a space-time motive force, from somewhere above the earth, to the surface of the ground. When that happens, there are certain effects that appear. And one of them are the presence of certain exotic materials, crystalline in structure, but also there tends to be a large deposits of quartz, which tend to also be linked to gold. We just don't understand enough if the gold is relevant or not. It's something that's very, very hard to study. We just don't have enough data that's statistically significant to help us understand that.
What about superconductivity? You talked about superconductivity in some other YouTube. I heard that you were saying it's very important.
Yeah, well, superconductivity is important for some things that we're doing, but it's actually in the 1990s, we did think that advancements in superconductor technologies would be really key to what we're doing. We're beginning to realize as we become, and the reason for that was controlling the boundary layer of a time warp field. We thought superconductors would be the answer. We finally solved that control problem, and it basically removed our dependence on the need for any new advancements in superconductor technology, which would be extremely cost prohibitive anyway for the scale of what we're doing.
Okay, and anything, do you use it all in your technology? Anything like Tesla coils or pyramidal shapes or octahedral shapes?
There are several geometric shapes that are very relevant. We just find that tends to lend some efficiency. What was the other part of this besides shapes?
Well, I asked about the Tesla coil.
Oh, Tesla coil. No, I mean, of course, when we introduced the rotating electromagnetic field, there are coils involved in that. But as far as like Tesla coils specifically, no.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Say hello to the creatures in the sky. I know they're somewhere out there, big enough to hold me.
Welcome to the Peter Moon Podcast, brought to you by Sky Books and the music of Lisa.
Okay, so this is part 6 of podcast number 8 with Dr. David Anderson. And, we were just talking in our break about that I had been traveling in the same areas that you'd asked a question, Sean, about the...
I just thought it was interesting that David mentioned that in the sedimentary level that some proof had been found that some time travel may have taken place in that area.
Yeah, and when you said that, Sean, my first reaction... was yes, you know, we noticed that when space-time modus force is discharged and it strikes the surface of the Earth, there is a creation of certain exotic materials that is somewhat common. And what's interesting, in the sedimentary layer at Chio Covina Cave, there's a high concentration of three exotic materials that are very common at a discharge point when that occurs. And what's really interesting is they occur in the sedimentary layer where there really is no natural explanation for that. And what, there's been a few theories presented, but none of them really hold any water. And what was really amazing, I've known that for a few years, and so we had some theories about, is it possible that much earlier than us, at a much earlier place in time, there was a space-time motive force discharge in that area of Romania in the southern Carpathians. I've known that for years. I didn't even put it together with the fact, with Peter's research that he had been doing, like up at Sarmacejituja, in that whole area of the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. And, Peter, I was just curious, how far is the area you're researching at Sarmacejituja and the Chio Covina Caves?
Okay, well, when I... have been to Sarmacejituja at least 3 times, maybe 4. I've stayed at the Cotizo Hotel in Costesti. And Costesti is a small little town of a few thousand. And there's a Kostesti fortress up there that you can walk to. And this is very interesting. When I was there getting an initiation from my friend Tatiana, she explained to me that this is where Pythagoras was. This is where I think she said Jesus of Nazareth was. I don't know what this means. I don't judge these statements. But they got their initiations in this place, and you're walking up these steps and whatnot. Certainly Pythagoras. And it was a seat of ancient wisdom. There was some very interesting phenomena. And then this girl, a lovely lady from the UK, came over. She wanted to be a part of what we were doing last May. And she got an initiation from Tatiana in this same area. When I went there, it was sunny. When she came, it was rainy. So it was like I was dealing with the element of fire. This lady was dealing – I'm not going to say her name because, oh, boy, she's charged with some interesting information that ties to the Damanhur community. I'm not going to mention her name. But she had to confront the water and the wetness. So we were like going under the trees. When that initiation finished and we got into Tatiana's car, the thunder happened and the rain poured. The minute we got in the car, it was like we were talking to the elements. And the thunder is the – I don't know if I've ever discussed this with you, David, but the indigenous spirits of that area are called the Sulamanare. And they often disguise themselves or appear as shepherds or sheep. And they will take you to a cave for initiation. You will have an experience. And I've seen this happen. I mean, it's real. It's not a joke. And, of course, accessing them is as simple as going there and being open. But the thunder. And so, you know, I'm already – you're asking me a simple question about the distance, and I'm telling you, well, I stay at this place called the Cotizo Hotel that is owned by the Stanku family. Christina is the young, beautiful lady who has been my very close friend from the minute I laid eyes on her, and her brother Alex, and they both speak, you know, very good English, and the mother Maria, and the father Nikolai, and they have this beautiful hotel that's, you know, you have to go up a dirt road to get there, but it's got all the modern conveniences. And anyway, I stayed there, and we drove from there. Now, if you drive to Sarmizegetuza from that locale, it might be a very short distance if you were to hang glide, so to speak. If you were a crow, it wouldn't take far at all. But because of the roads in the mountains, it might take a half an hour, 45 minutes to get to Sarmizegetuza. And you go down another road and take 50 minutes to get to Chaklavina Cave. So how far it is in terms of miles, I don't think is very far. But you're going up these... This is a mountainous area.
Well, for me, that's incredible. It's an incredible synchronicity because, if I'm using the word right, because what we see, we've only seen one location, one unexplained area where the exotic materials that typically are present at the discharge point of space-time motive force, and there's only one place we know of on the planet, halfway around the world from us right now, and somehow that's right next to where you've been researching and studying. And, you know, I'm not qualified to comment on a lot of your research and work, but for me, it's made my head spin just a little bit, realizing that literally these two points are in the same neighborhood.
Well, yes,
so it'll be interesting to see what we learn in the coming years about this, because it's a little bit too much of a coincidence.
Well, yes, and if you when you look into this... this chapter, it's the final chapter of Radu's part of the Secret Parchment, where he talks about the gold and a fascinating history of Romania in there, but which might be a little tedious for some people, but boy, it's important. I mean, you read about the language of it being the original language and this sort of stories and whatnot. But I should tell you, and David, you know Romanian language better than I do, but people don't generally understand that the language was changed from the Cyrillic alphabet to the Latin alphabet after the Crimean War. And then yes. there was the Revolution of 1848. The language was changed to create this fiction that Romanian is a Latin language when it's really the other way around. And this is a big issue that has been obfuscated. But that's just another, I'm trying to get you interested in reading the other parts of the book. But when they talk about this golden area, there is a bed of pure gold that's got hieroglyphics, which they take to about three or four universities and figure out that it says basically a Creo Samos. Creo means KR is like Kronos, time. EO they didn't really figure out, but I understand that as an iteration of the Dios. 1-0, EO, IO, it's the deity, it's the god of time. They consider this the center of time. And it also mentions Creo Salmas. Salmas is for Zalmoxis, which they didn't figure that out. I figured that out, and so did my translator. But this is a bed of gold, which would be like a perfect remote viewing bed, which I think it might have been used for, with the superconductivity of the gold as it applies to the human brain. But they explain, this thing says it's the center of time. And furthermore, this is where the legend of Santa Claus comes out of. It's covered in the book that Santa Claus, you know, because Santa's like moving in time like crazy to give all these gifts. It goes into a little bit of the history of Santa Claus from this area of the planet, and you see how everything sort of, according to this history, legend, whatever you want to call it, this is the origin of time, is what it says. As you go further through these tunnels of gold, you get to seven golden thrones with a hieroglyphics surrounding them. Again, this is the book, The Secret Parchment, Five Tibetan Initiation Techniques. And there's hieroglyphics surrounding them, and there's some sort of elliptical vortex in between them that is really literally a portal to another world. Maybe it's a giant time reactor. I can't tell. These are fantastic aspects of the book. But they are saying that this is the center of time. I know that Preston said that Montauk was the center of time. Well, the center of time has many resonant points or center, certainly a focal point of time. But, you know, back to answer your original question, it's a 50-minute drive from the Cotizo, and if you ever have occasion to go there, they will know who you are, and they have very nice accommodations.
I'm way past due for a visit to Romania, so maybe I need to pick up and pick up where some of your studies have taken everybody and see what I can learn up there.
Well, as they say, we have, you know, if I can be there with you, I'd be happy to. And I have, you know, talk about adventures. Talk about adventures. Wow. It could be a lot of fun. So anyway, Sean, do you have any questions you want to ask?
Actually, I got one. I've been thinking about one, David. It might be a silly question, but is there any story from the past, any book or movie about time travel that has been close to what you've come across? Is there any story that maybe any of your colleagues have related that said, hey, this guy was pretty close?
The first one would be the writings of Buddha.
Right.
The Indian culture also, you know, their culture, you know, there are so many things that are foreign to our understanding of what our reality and our universe is. In the Indian culture, I mentioned earlier, just subtly, that they're so good at what they do. One of the reasons is their culture has developed over thousands of years to really accept these things. They're much more accepting, whereas the typical, let's say, American has to come to an epiphany, some type of aha moment before he can start considering these. These are just ingrained. So studying the Indian culture, studying the work of Buddha, I mentioned that the work of John Archibald Wheeler and Edwin Taylor, yes. Book called Space Time Physics is very good. As far as science fiction, Oh boy, you know, actually, I got to tell you, Sean, you had a great question here, because honestly, there have always been a lot of preconceived notions of what time control and time travel would look like, and what we're seeing in time control experiments actually is bringing a whole new perspective. There are so many new things, and that's one of the new videos that we're putting out, is some of the things we've learned. Like, for example, the idea that the concept of parallel simultaneous universes, we're seeing evidence that pretty much is saying the exact opposite. Okay. So a lot of the books out there and the common threads that you'll see, we're seeing disproved. People talking about the amount of energy to create a field, a time dilation field, we're seeing that busted. We're seeing the parallel universe busted. We're seeing constructs of reality busted. So the answer is, it's a good question, because honestly, I think it's the exact opposite. We're seeing a lot of new, brand new perspectives that have very little to do with what people would say would be the common expectation. And for me, that's exciting, and that's why I think one of the videos we produce on the technology side will be very interesting to a lot of people.
Well, thank you very much. That's great.
It's a good answer, and I want to mention to you, David, because you mentioned the Indian culture. In this book, Transylvanian Moonrise, it talks about, and to some degree in The Secret Parchment, it talks about how if you study the fauna and the flora mentioned in the Mahabharata, the ancient Indian text, which is one of their great texts, that the flora and fauna match that of Transylvania. And we're being told that it's about the ancient adventures of Rama and his wife, Sita, and that they actually took place on a mountain in Transylvania, and that I guess they said it was a space-time place as well. But the Vedic culture comes out of this area, and you know Bulgarian language at least a little bit, and the third letter of the alphabet is Vede, like Veda. So you get this. They say that all these people came from those mountains, the Caucasus Mountains. Well, you'll find that in ancient history, Transylvania was supported during the Ice Age. It didn't freeze up. And in addition to that, you have all those caves which people could go in and survive in as well. So this is really, according to what I've studied here, it's the antecedent of our culture. And so if it's the human factor, it's also the time factor. And these are very interesting things that I get a chance to tell you in this podcast, where I might not otherwise even mention it, because, you know, you have so much time to read, et cetera. And I've certainly stimulated your interest in, you know, perhaps revisiting Romania. And I'm hoping to do that next year. What were you going to say?
Yeah, I hope I have that opportunity and our paths will cross there one day. And I also wanted to thank you again, the work you're doing with the youth here, but also that recent article, the recent publication you did on closed time-like curves. What I really liked about it, not only did you capture the essence, but you put it in a perspective that makes it a little more easily understood by people to actually help understand, see, and visualize it better. And with your permission, I'd like to be using that and handing that out in some of our upcoming lectures.
Well, yes, of course. And what I'm going to do, see, this actually, this for those who are listening, it hasn't been quite published yet. By the time it's still, I'm going to adjust a few few sentences after our talk, because I didn't know if the pod, I'm going to announce that the podcast did indeed happen, because at that time I wrote it, I didn't know. So I'm going to change a few sentences in it. But, of course, and I'm going to put it in a format that's a little more academic friendly. I'm going to put in a little bit different. And yes, of course you may. Of course you may. Because I will.
You.
Yes, of course you may. And it's. I'm going to put. It's the copyright of both of us, because it's all based upon what you did. I just made it a little more simpler, not coming from a physics and technical background as yourself. Because I know you guys can talk on a language. I can talk in languages that other people can't understand, and I know that you can too. So when we put it into common English and common concepts, it helps this education process. So, as you said, I hope you will send me some more things to deconstruct if I can. I'm happy to do that. And I look forward to doing it because it broadens my understanding of these matters. And
it's been a real pleasure speaking with you and Sean today. And I thank you again for the opportunity. It's been a while since I've spoken publicly. And I think, as I might have mentioned to you earlier, you'll probably see us making 3 or 4 public presentations next year, probably at a few select universities. So we should see some more information flowing out, which is a big part of our plan to, for disclosure.
Well, yes, and I should also address a couple other topics. You know, we had discussed the prospect of you doing something together that, you know, I will send you. I mean, you know, people that may want to learn more about this. So I will certainly keep people. I should also mention that this article is in my newsletter, The Montauk Pulse, which you can find on my website, skybooksusa.com. It's by subscription. But also, yes, there might be some opportunities that you might be doing some presentations, and we're certainly looking forward to your videos. And anything else you want to say before we wrap this up, David?
No, just thanks so much, and just encourage your listeners again to read and read and read and learn. And just wish you all the best. Peter and Sean, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, but I want to ask you one other thing. People are going to listen to this, and they say, we want David to be on our radio show, or bop, 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 bop. Some of the people you have been on with before, some of them you haven't. I don't know how available you are. I mean, I will forward their requests. Anything you want to say about that? Are you going to be able, are you open for interviews at this time?
It's most likely I will not be doing any interviews until September. At that point, from September on, I'll probably take about 9 or 10 months and be a little more available. My focus is really in the work that I'm undertaking right now. I have some very important goals that I hope to achieve, and when I do get in front of any listeners, I hope to have some very, very interesting and new information that they haven't seen before on the subject.
Well, certainly you've provided some of that tonight, and it's people are always excited to hear more. They always want it, like when you're gone for a long time, they want to know what's going on, and I'll say, I don't know. And but basically, what you've offered here is it's all a process of education and learning and keeping it simple, and I'll do my best to help you do that. And I want to, you know, thank you, Sean, especially, and thanks again. And we don't know what the next podcast is going to be on, but you'll all find out.
All right. Thank you.
Wonderful.
This concludes podcast number 8 with Dr. David Anderson. In the future, we're hoping to hold at least a couple of public discussions, lectures with myself and Dr. David Anderson. Date and locations have yet to be determined. In the meantime, if you visit digitalmontauk.com, go to the menu bar on Mathematics of Time, you can get a free copy of the Montauk Pulse newsletter, which will describe the math and physics of time control technology,